The Fish and Game Commission will start in a couple of minutes. Fish and Game Commission meeting. I'm Richard Rogers of Carpinteria, would you believe? Yes, I live here. And I'm a lucky boy. Sitting immediately to my left is Cindy Gustafson, and Cindy's from Tahoe City. She's vice president of the commission. On her left is elder, not in years, but an experienced statesman on the commission, Jim Kellogg. And Jim's from Concord. Immediately, we'll get to him in a minute. To his right is Michael Sutton from Monterey, and immediately to his right is Dan Richards from Upland. And immediately to my right is John Carlson from nowhere, I think. I don't know, Sacramento or something like that. Chicago, somewhere here. From the department tonight, today rather, we have Saki Mastrup, who's deputy director of the department. I don't believe everyone else went. Yes. Sonky.
We're lucky to have you.
We are lucky. Chief Nancy Foley is standing in the back, along with Roland Takayama and Jorge Gross, our wardens today. Deborah Barnes, our deputy district, attorney general, is here. Our award-winning staff, Sherry Cole and Anita, are sitting over there. And our deputy executive director, John Fisher, is being talked to by the executive director, and Adriana Shea is someplace. At least she was here. So let's see. Do we have it? There she comes. Where is she?
She stuck her head in the door.
Stuck her head in the door. Okay. So I think that's it for everyone who is here. So, John, take it away.
Thank you, Richard. Welcome, everyone. It's 8:08. I guess that's a lucky day for some people. And we are going to be starting up with some items we did not finish yesterday. First, just a little bit of housekeeping. I want to remind everyone we're live streaming on the internet, and so everything you say and speak to at the microphone will be on tape, and it's available later through our website as archived. It's free to the public. We have an aggregate speaking time today of 10 minutes. If you're interested in speaking on items, please turn in a green card to staff and with the agenda items you want to speak on. We also ask folks to keep your comments to the microphone. If you are in the audience making comments or catcalls, we really don't appreciate that, and we'll ask you to stop that. Starting today, where we ended up yesterday, we're going to be on item 7, receipt of commission informational items. And, commissioners, there's a couple things here I want to report on to you. Item 1, report on joint meeting with Nevada Board of Wildlife Commissioners scheduled for September and discussion of possible agenda items. In your binders, you should have a list of possible agenda items. Let me double check that it's in the binder. It's a separate handout. And let me go over those real quick with you. Let's see. Thank you. Suggested items we have, and we're planning on starting that meeting at 8:30 in the morning, and spending the day with the Nevada Board of Wildlife Commissioners. They have a 9-commissioner board. The last time we had a joint meeting with them was in summer of 2002, so it's definitely high time to get together again. There's a lot of issues that we share with them, and of the suggestions here, we have alien species issues, quagga mussels, New Zealand mud snail, barramundi. These are in no particular order. These are put together by discussions between our staff and their staff in Nevada and staff with the Department of Fish and Game in California. Interstate deer management is a hot topic. Sage grouse, which are listed, are petitioned through the federal process to be listed. That's a big topic. Agency overviews, agency I think it would be good to get a picture of, you know, where they're heading as an agency and where we are. Tahoe bear situation has really, really grown. It's grown a lot since the last time we met with them in 02. And there's a state-to-state MOU that can be explained and talked about how that's working. I think Commissioner Gustafson has personal experience with that. Bighorn sheep management. I'm sorry. Bighorn sheep, you know, the endangered Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep and issues really related to domestic sheep interaction with those sheep and disease issues, that's another hot topic. And overall emerging issues we could talk about. Threatened species, threatened and endangered, the state of Nevada does not have their own state act, and I don't know if we want to talk about that or not. And then law enforcement MOU on shared jurisdiction, I believe that's going to be something that Nancy would like to talk about when we're with them. And it's my understanding is that's a very good MOU that we're working with them on, and she can give some details later on how that's working out.
I don't think they have a need for an Endangered Species Act in Nevada because whatever happens in Nevada stays in Nevada. Isn't it true?
I just wanted to make sure that on that agenda is the bear issue at Lake Tahoe, because in 2002 when we met with them, they said they didn't have an issue with bears. They only had three or four on their side of the border.
Yeah, it has changed a lot since we've successfully given them a lot. No, I'm just... there's a yeah. That's a joke. I'm just kidding for folks in the audience. Yes, the bear issue has really blossomed over there, and I think that would be a good thing to talk about. You know, I will be working with President Rogers on a final agenda. We'll be sending draft agendas around. I just wanted to, you know, bring this to your attention and see if there was anything that really stuck out for you. we're probably going to trim this down a bit because 9 items, as you can imagine, with 2 boards and 2 departments talking about it, could be more than a day's worth of stuff to talk about. But if there's anything that's really glaring here that's missing on this list that you would like added, or if there's anything you really think needs to be dropped right now, that would be fine. And you could also let me know later.
Good. Thank you.
The other thing I wanted to bring up was item 27A2, report on the 2008 Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies Conference. That was held in Rapid City, South Dakota in early July. I was able to attend that on behalf of the commission. The commissioner's committee for all the western states held 2 meetings and also held a joint meeting with all the Western directors, and I thought it was fairly successful. There was a lot of interesting things shared there. As usual, California has a lot of cutting-edge issues that the other states are just now starting to see, from workforce issues, budget issues, wildlife interaction issues. The good news is, well, it's kind of a double-edged sword. The good news, maybe bad news, is California is hosting both of the Western Association meetings in 2009. This is going to be an enormous effort. The department and commission staff are going to be working on that. It's going to take a lot of my time, a lot of our staff's time. The summer meeting is going to be in July of 09 in Newport Beach. The midwinter meeting's in San Francisco in early January. I think it'll be a great opportunity for commissioners to interact with about 30 or 40 commissioners from the western states and Canadian provinces. I'll be closely in touch with you folks on the plans for that and agenda items and what kind of interactions will be happening.
I understand the closest hotel that is at state rate to Newport Beach is in Riverside. Is that true?
Might be, yeah, Ontario.
More like Hemet.
Hemet, yeah. Thermal.
Yeah. And we are actually working on a good deal there.
Good.
So, We're working on a group rate there. I think that the department has actually hired a consultant that is an expert at putting these types of large meetings together. Normally about 300 to 400 folks from the western states, and these are directors and commissioners and top staff, come to these summer meetings. So it's quite an event. We're working on a theme for the meeting. This last theme was in South Dakota, was looking at the changing face of our employees with everybody retiring and the new folks coming in and different attitudes. So that was quite a, you know, there was a lot of discussion on that. We're working on a theme for the 09 conference. And if you have any input on that, I'm definitely open to that. 7A3, discussion of 2009 regulatory calendar and possible regulatory proposals. John, do we have a slide that AGP can put up on the screen?
Could be a regulatory schedule slide. Regulatory schedule? That's one you guys gave me.
Make sure these guys know that we, the two of us, will be fundraising. A likely story. Oh, the one fly.
Oh. I'm good.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, so what fly are you going to pick this year? What fly are you going to pick this year?
I don't know. We'll wait and see.
Well, while we're waiting for technological expertise to catch up with us, let me talk with Sonke Mastrup a bit about this concept of talking about the 09 regulatory calendar. For the commissioner's benefit here and the Office of Administrative Law, every January we turn in a sketch for the 12 months of what type of regulatory workload we're looking at. Turn that into the Office of Administrative Law. It's not a binding calendar we turn in, but it gives us a flavor of what our workload is going to be. We ask for department input usually by the end of December, early January, and we get that to the Office of Administrative Law by the end of January. We wanted to kind of kick that off earlier this year because, you know, we always seem to be a little bit behind the eight ball on planning, and we wanted to start it earlier rather than later this year. And You're making me dizzy. Look at that. But nice, beautiful colors. I like that. This is our baseline that we really have as our base for every year. As you can see, mammal regs, ocean salmon, Klamath tritidae, Central Valley salmon, waterfowl, upland game, herring, ocean fishing, inland fishing. So that's the base. And then we get to add several other things. And usually the calendar only catches less than 50% of what we, you know, the calendar usually catches about 50% of our workload for the year, and then there's other things added on. So I kind of would like to give the department a chance, give them a heads up that we're looking for earlier input. I wanted to give the commissioners notice that if you have something on your mind for the 09 cycle that, you know, over the next few meetings, it would be great to hear about that so staff can tee it up. Did you want to add anything on this, Sonke?
Yeah. In the interest of the department staff, being your regulatory staff, to give you the best product available and do the scoping, if you look at that calendar, you see the notice is the first dot. There actually should be a scoping discussion months before that to really tee these things up properly. So kind of what we're looking for is, if, like John said, if there's of a particular regulatory thing of interest, the sooner we know about it, we can figure out, given your workload and our workload, when would we put it on there, which will then allow us to backdate when we need to start holding meetings with publics, getting the word out, and kind of doing that scoping stuff that is producing, I think, a more involved, comprehensive regulatory package in the end for you. So we have our kind of standards. There's a few cleanup things that you'll be hearing from us that probably at the next meeting give you some thoughts. But if there's any particular agendas or issues you want to wrestle with, we'd like to know. We can give you an idea of how much time that might take. Obviously, some are real easy. Some could be a lot more complex. And so we'll want to make sure we get enough time in for the public to get involved and us get prepared.
Questions from the commissioners? We actually have one speaker card carry over from yesterday on this, Paul Weakland. Paul, if you wanted to comment.
No, thank you.
And I think I mentioned earlier, if anybody wants to speak on the agenda items for today, please turn in a card. We still are going to cover 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 from yesterday. So if you want to carry over from yesterday, please turn in your card. So that moves us to item 8. Subcommittee reports and recommendations. Marine Resources Committee.
Good morning. I have just three items under this this agenda item. First of all, the Marine Advisor for the Commission. You'll recall that we have been engaged in a recruitment effort to hire or rehire the Marine Advisor position for the Commission that has been vacant for several years now. We raised some private funds to help pay for 2 years of Marine Advisor to help our staff handle the increasing burden of Marine issues before the Commission. We got a couple of examples of the issues today that we'll be dealing with. The Commission approved the terms of reference for Marine Advisor back in December of last year, and we interviewed a couple of candidates. We only had a couple of applicants the first time around, so we're going back out and opening that recruitment up again for applicants. So we'll keep you informed as that search proceeds. If anybody has an interest or knows of others who have an interest in serving as the Marine Advisor to the Commission and staffing the Commission's Marine Resources Committee, please let us know. On a related note, issues that was identified during our scoping exercise earlier this year by the stakeholders of the Marine Resource Committee was the need to take a good look at the performance of the Marine Life Management Act, the state's principal fisheries statute. Marine Life Management Act has been around for 10 years. It's been implemented for a little bit less than that. We have three fishery management plans, four if you count abalone. Stakeholders have expressed, you heard some of this yesterday, stakeholders have expressed various levels of satisfaction with the provisions of the Marine Life Management Act, generally considered one of the more progressive fishery management statutes of any state in the nation. However, it's not perfect, and there are many ways it can be improved. So we heard a lot about that in the scoping exercise that we conducted earlier this year for the Marine Resources Committee, and we've been looking for a way to take a comprehensive look at the performance of the statute over the last several years. You heard yesterday that legislation has been proposed that would amend the Marine Life Management Act. There are all kinds of efforts underway to figure out how to improve the performance of the statute. We thought that probably the best way to deal with that is to conduct a comprehensive sort of lessons learned review of the MLMA in the same manner that was done for the MLPA, the Marine Life Protection Act, a year or so ago, that led to improvements in the MLPA initiative process on the North Central Coast. So with that in mind, we've gone to the Ocean Protection Council, which has Proposition 84 money, and we've asked them if they would underwrite a lessons learned exercise on the MLMA in cooperation with the Commission. They have agreed to put that on their agenda for their meeting next month, and they will be taking up a staff recommendation to fund a comprehensive review of the MLMA at their meeting on September 11th in Half Moon Bay. So those of you who are concerned or interested in the performance of the MLMA may want to register your support for that exercise at the Ocean Protection Council. We're going to try to make this a joint initiative. The Ocean Protection Council will not do this in isolation. It'll work obviously closely with the department and closely with the commission in carrying out this review.
That was Half Moon Bay. Right?
Half Moon Bay, that's right. It's the Oceano Hotel in Half Moon Bay on September 11th, 2008. They're going to be taking up the staff recommendation, and hopefully the council will approve the funding for this exercise. So we'll have independent funding for both the Marine Advisor and the main project the Marine Resources Committee wants to undertake this year, a comprehensive review of the MLMA. I should note that the Ocean Protection Council, in many ways, is the mirror image of the commission. The OPC has no direct authority, but they've got money. We have lots of direct authority, but no money. So in many respects, this is a great marriage of two state institutions that have a lot to do with an interest in the oceans. So that hopefully will be a useful exercise, and we're going to obviously depend on all of you to give us advice on just what should be considered as part of that review of the MLMA. The only other item I have is we are desperately trying to schedule our next meeting of the Marine Resources Committee. It's kind of embarrassing that we haven't had one in a couple of months now, but the problem has been scheduling. We tried to find a date next month to hold the meeting, but because of getting Commissioner Rogers, President Rogers, and myself in the same place at the same time is proving more challenging than we thought. So we're looking at options of how to schedule the meetings, perhaps even in conjunction with commission meetings. Might be easier since those are scheduled ahead of time. We're all here. Perhaps extending doing a MRC meeting on Friday afternoon, something like that. So we're looking for your ideas on that score as well. President Rogers, any comment?
No, it's been very frustrating, and unfortunately our schedules are almost impossible. But in any event, I think the idea of doing it on either before or after the commission meeting is a good idea. That way we can start on Wednesday and get home on Sunday. You know, that's lovely. I mean, that's really a good idea. No, if that's the only way we can do it, that's what we have to do.
Thank you. Item 8B, L. Tauscher, Preserving Hunting and Sport Fishing Opportunities Advisory Committee. We are working on a date to get our next meeting. Mr. Fisher, you want to comment at all? Since your microphone's on.
Yeah, it's on. Just that we're working with commissioners to try to establish the next date. We were going to be scheduled to meet September 30th, I believe, in the Owens Valley. But since we're changing the commission meeting location from Bishop area over to the North Central Coast, we're going to postpone that meeting and try to do it at a different time. So want to get together with Commissioner Kellogg and Commissioner Richards and see if we can get a date that will work out well. And hopefully that'll be this fall.
I have two speaker cards on item 8. Paul Weekland and Harry LeCornick.
Commissioners, Paul Weekland, about the Marine Resources Committee meeting. It's obvious what's going on. You have issues that you don't want to see the light of day. It's nothing but redundancy, and that's why it keeps getting put off. We notice it's very visible that only staff recommendations and not the public's recommendations are being brought forth. It's what Mr. Michael Sutton wants to talk about. He doesn't want to talk about scientific harvesting permits and the abuses there. He doesn't want to talk about the aquariums and the collection of different species. He doesn't want to talk about the 147 marine specialists that are now full paid by the Department of Fish and Game. He wants his own little advisor to tell him what he wants to hear. We have questions and concerns about restricted access fishing and many other things that are years old that we still haven't gotten responded to. This just shows a lack of real concern with what's going on. The true objective is to stall, stymie, and stop any progress. We have a process, but no progress, and that's what he wants.
Thank you, Mr. Wiglin.
Harry LeCornick.
Oh, you got the negative, and I'll try and bring some positive. Thank you, commissioners. I really appreciate it when you got the Marine Resources Committee up and going again, and looking at the broader and bigger picture stuff is great. And bringing the meetings back, you know, the day before the commission meetings is a great idea, because the usual suspects are always gathering in the usual places where you meet. So I think that's a but I would also encourage you to prior the meetings were also a good area for us to come in and use as a sounding board. I know you didn't want lobbying, Adam, and that's much appreciated, but it's a good arena for us to come in and bounce ideas off of you. Example, like yesterday would have been the Laird bill. We could have given you an update ahead of time, or if you're meeting on a more regular basis, that, hey, we're having trouble working with this bill. So it's a great forum for us to get feedback from you gentlemen and bounce ideas off you. So I would really encourage you to get them rolling again. Thank you.
We're trying, Harry. Thank you.
Thank you, Harry. You know, it's been a little bit of a dilemma for us because in the past, as you know, the Marine Resources Committee was kind of used as a dress rehearsal for the commission meetings, and we didn't think that was the best use of the committee's time. So we planned to kind of have them separate from the commission meetings. On the other hand, logistics suggests that it's a lot easier to schedule them in conjunction with a commission meeting because all the stakeholders are here, we're here, you know. So whether they're before or after a commission meeting, we're going to be forced to look at that timing just out of necessity. But we're still looking for the best use of the committee's resources. The committee was actually set up by statute. The commission is required to have a Marine Resources Committee. Given that, we want to make the best possible use of it, which to me is talking about things in greater depth and detail than we have time for at commission meetings. So, and of course, this MLPA, if the MLMA lessons learned exercise gets underway and is funded by the Ocean Protection Council, we're going to be devoting a fair amount of time. That's going to be the MRC meetings are going to be our opportunity for public input. So that'll be pretty important.
That moves us on to item number 9, receipt of federal agencies informational items. We have Tony Morton from NIMFS.
Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, President Rogers, Commissioners. Tony Morton with NOAA Fisheries. I just had a couple of brief items to report on to you today. You'll recall that last September we experienced some unfortunate collisions between ships and blue whales in the Santa Barbara Channel, with 3 whales confirmed killed by ship strikes. In response to a request from members of the Channel Islands Sanctuary Advisory Council, NOAA staff from Channel Islands and from the Southwest Regional Fisheries Office drafted a response plan intended to avoid or minimize interactions between ships and whales. We're still working to finalize the plan, but we aren't waiting to take actions because whales are in the channel now, and we expect their numbers and frequency to increase through November. NOAA met with the members of the Southern California Marine Exchange, the Coast Guard, and the shipping industry, and we came to agreement on providing a notice to mariners, which is currently being broadcast over the radio twice a day, and it is also being distributed via published notices and over the Internet. The current notice is not focused only on blue whales, but all whales that occur in the channel. Maps of confirmed whale sightings are also being provided to the ships, complete with coordinates, so they have a regular report on where the whales were spotted. While we're not currently asking ships to slow down, a request for the largest ships to slow down to 10 to 12 knots will be broadcast if it's confirmed that whales are appearing within certain areas of the channel in aggregations of 5 or more. The strategy is to depend primarily on trained observers and whale watch boats reporting whale sightings, with subsequent confirmation by survey aircraft from either the sanctuary, the Coast Guard, or the Fish and Game Department. For the longer term, NOAA intends to continue an ongoing review of whale behavior and our discussions with the Coast Guard and shipping industry about other non-regulatory management options that may be available to us. If what we're doing now or what we're considering doing for non-regulatory options don't appear to be working, then we may consider proposing regulations of some sort. And then my second item is this past April at the Bodega Bay meeting, I reported on a proposed rulemaking that would amend the Coastal Pelagic Species Fisheries Management Plan to prohibit the development of a krill fishery in the exclusive economic zone off the West Coast. In May, the Office of Management and Budget authorized NOAA Fisheries to proceed with the rulemaking, and in June, we asked for public comments on the rule. We have now responded to the comments and are preparing a Federal Register notice announcing the final rule, which will become Amendment 12 to the Pelagic Fisheries Management Plan, and that will in effect provide consistency with the existing state laws in California, Oregon, and Washington, which prohibit krill landings. So we're happy about that. I know you were looking forward to having that happen as well.
Tony, I have a question for you on that notice that you were going to broadcast, that somebody's going to get out twice a day. Is the Coast Guard going to do it using the Securité on 16 mechanism? How are they going to do this?
I think they're using that frequency or that channel. Also, the National Weather Service through the weather radio will be broadcasting that. And then the Marine Exchange has regular communications with
them. Yeah, I would hardly recommend using 16. You know, because they have to monitor that. They, you know, some of those guys, well, you know what they're like on those bridges.
I guess you're a boat operator, so maybe you can check on that and see if they're
interesting.
Actually happening.
Yeah. Thank you, Tony.
Okay,
thank Any you. Questions, comments?
Right, thank you.
Item, I'm sorry, we have one public speaker on that item number 9, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Another lesson in tyranny and futility. We have for years asked questions in a timely manner, both written and oral, about the failed Mammal Protection Act of the federal government, the otter zonal concept, the failures in the black-white abalone policies that have been set down, military operations that are degrading and eroding our habitat and species off the West Coast. Yet we get no answers, and you are sticking up for this stalling, stonewalling, and this is the way our government works. It's true tyranny what you're involved in, and not having them and requesting them to make apparent and public notice of what our concerns and questions have been about black and white abalones, the failed federal policies that are crippling our fisheries, and it's just despicable.
Thank you, Mr. Wicklund. Number 10.
Item 10, receipt of legal counsel informational items. We have Deputy Attorney General Deborah Barnes has a few words of wisdom.
I can only hope.
Legal wisdom.
Good morning, Commissioners and Mr. President. I've been asked to just give you a few words on the concept of serial meetings out of Bagley Keene. There's no way to make this a really fascinating and interesting thing, so I'm really grateful that Adriana brought coffee for everyone this morning. I thought maybe, you know, serial, we could do something with that theme, but no, it's a different kind of serial. Okay, we'll move on. It's the best
I'm sorry. What was the middle part? I got lost.
That's the best I could do to kind of make this a little more interesting and a little less dry. But basically, I've been asked to just very briefly remind the commissioners about the prohibition under Bagley Keene against serial meetings. And very briefly stated, serial meetings are there's a couple of types, but it's in essence when there's a communication between one commissioner and another, which would not be a quorum, which can be fine, but then it spreads out to involve a quorum or a majority of the commissioners. And it can happen in a number of ways. It can happen if Commissioner A speaks to Commissioner B, and then the Commissioner B speaks to Commissioner C. It can also happen if there's one individual who speaks to all five commissioners. All five commissioners about a certain topic and provides information and solicits comments and opinions, what have you, or if that person shares with all five commissioners. It can also happen verbally. You need to watch for email traffic, text messaging, telephone calls. That can all equate to a serial meeting, which is prohibited under the Act. It can also happen vis-a-vis members of the public. In essence, if a member of the public contacts or provides information to a commissioner that ends up getting spread to all five commissioners, that is also prohibited under the Act. The basic principle being that all of your information should be obtained, discussed, and deliberated in public. I know you all know this. Just a brief reminder that it's very easy to even unintentionally engage in that type of activity just in the normal course of conversations or business. I've reminded you all, social gatherings are permissible. There's a explicit exception under Bagley Keene for social gatherings as long as business isn't discussed. In terms of just a brief review of any violations for under Bagley-Keene, they can range from any decisions can be overturned, and you end up paying attorney's fees and costs, which in this day and budget times is can be an onerous thing for a state department. It can range from that all the way to criminal misdemeanor charges if it's a knowing violation of the act. That's about all I have, unless anyone has any questions.
Any questions?
One thing I'd like to add is the cautions on email. And I'm not sure if you had mentioned that.
I had mentioned it very briefly, but you're absolutely right. Email is a very easy way to unintentionally even come into violation of the act. I don't know if any of you have ever done this. You hit the wrong send button, and off it goes. And that's something, and it leaves a trail. It's just something to be very cautious of.
Counsel, just for clarification, are you suggesting that if we find, for example, a news article that we think might be of interest to our fellow commissioners and staff, that by broadcasting that to everyone, we'd be violating Bagley-Keene?
I think that could be a violation of Bagley-Keene. My suggestion would be to email that to your executive director and have him include that in the informational packet to the commissioners in the normal course of business. Would be probably a more conservative and safer bet.
Any further questions?
I don't know that I completely agree with that, by the way. I've read Bagley-Keene more times than I want to. Certainly respect your opinion, but sharing information with other commissioners is not coming to an agreement or voting on something or telling people how we're going to do things. I think it's important that we absolutely live up to the letter of the law. I think that's critical. But I also... I'm not challenged at all with getting an email from any of you that goes to everybody else that says, this was an interesting article on the salmon fishery. So we can be too careful here and never be able to accomplish anything. And if we don't have information, then I think it stymies our ability to actually do the job that we're supposed to do. Having said that, we need to absolutely live up to the letter of the law. It's important. It's not an option, and I think we should do that. But I have a slightly different take on it.
Deborah, I think Commissioner Richards has an important point. One of the things that's really of the essence with this kind of – hang on a second – with this kind of a body is information. It's really critical. Is there a mechanism where – any one of us comes across an interesting article or something that in an obscure journal or, you know, or something off someplace else and knows fully well that the rest of the – and it's timely. It needs to be understood by the rest of the commissioners. Isn't it perfectly okay if that email goes to staff and it's immediately turned around and sent out to everybody? I mean, that's perfectly okay, isn't it?
I think that's a viable option, and I really appreciate Commissioner Richards' comments as well as Commissioner Rogers' comments. It really helps to move the conversation along, and it really helps to highlight some of the issues and the difficulties in looking at Bagley-Keene. So I cannot thank you enough for that. I also think that the danger, and you can obviously do whatever you'd like. I'm just here to be the gal who gives the best advice that she can. And when you have commissioners emailing each other, it just raises the specter of that issue. It's not just a matter of voting or how you're going to vote or coercing or cajoling or trying to get votes swayed. It's also this dissemination of information.
Well, absolutely. And let's talk a little bit about that, because while technically he's correct, what Commissioner Hanna had done, which came to everybody's attention and created quite a bit of issue, was he had given us information, but he had some editorial comments on it and certainly had a perspective. I think a good practice is to give it to our staff. Our staff keeps it as part of our public record of what we've considered mm-hmm. in deliberations on an issue,
right.
And then I think we're covered.
That's how
we deal with it in my agency, and
yeah.
We make sure our board members all get copies and it's kept in the public file, so if anyone asks, what articles did they see.
So we accomplished getting it out on a timely basis to each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the intent of my comments today are not to try to impede information, and I don't think Bagley Keene tries to impede information to the commissioners, and I think it's important that you all have the information that you need and that you think is important. And my, you know, this doesn't just come from me. It comes from the Attorney General's office as well, that there are times when, again, even inadvertently, there can be this issue. And, my suggestion would be you come across an article, you send it to your executive director, and then the information is disseminated from there and becomes part of the record. And therefore, you still get your information. Any specter of a violation is removed. And you can consider that as part of your normal course of business.
Commissioner Kellogg.
This is her job. And Bill Cunningham, verbatim, everything she has said over and over to us over the years, the same stuff. And it's, you know, and I took the same position with him that Dan's taken. There's my attitude is that the reason we have attorneys is to get us out of trouble if we do one of those things. As you know, this gives me an opportunity to explain to you guys why I don't answer your phone calls, why you've never received an email from me, and the constituents can understand now why I don't want to go have private meetings with them all the time like they're asking. That's the reason. So,
yes.
I have to agree with my fellow commissioners on this. Council, I think what we're asking you, you're providing great advice, and it's really appreciated, but I think what we're asking you is the Bagley Keene statute is restrictive enough on its face. We would like you to strictly construe it, not interpret it over broadly. And if because it's tough enough as it is without being interpreted even more broadly than the statute was intended. So
we certainly, and I certainly understand that perspective. And again, I really appreciate the comments from you all because it really helps me understand where you're coming from and how I can best meet your needs. I certainly hear what you're saying, and you know, I'm the first one to admit Bagley Keene can be awkward at best. However, I've litigated these issues, and what I'm here to do is kind of give you what parameters, you know, to give you the best advice so that when you're dealing with your substantive issues, there's no question about the process of what you're doing. So that's just my intent.
We understand that.
And if you have, you know, if you have any questions about this, if there's gray areas, I'm really happy to discuss it either with you individually or with through your executive director. And it's a lot easier to find some of those gray areas if you're dealing with a specific set of facts. So if somebody comes across an article or something that they want to send to the executive director or handle in some other way and there's a question about it, just give a call. And I'm just here to give information, and you're there to make the choices that you want to make. So
if we send the article to everybody and we say, attached is an article on salmon fishing, and I have absolutely no opinion on this, is that okay?
I think you'd have to sign it, but, you know.
Yeah. Unless I wrote it.
Yeah, unless you wrote the article. Yeah, exactly.
As always, I find you always interesting and intellectually stimulating questions.
Okay. Thank you.
One note I'd like to add from a staff perspective.
God, I thought we'd had enough on that.
It was close. We were really close. I just want to let the commissioners know that, remind you, in the past, we were sending news clippings once a week. The department has a service that electronically we get news clips from all over the world that deal with wildlife issues. That kind of fell apart when we lost one of our staff members earlier this year. He was the lead on it. We have a new person in that position now. We're going to get that rolling again. So I just want to give you a heads up. That was, you know, a temporary
thank you. I missed station
of that.
That was very informative.
And that really covers a lot of the topical articles covering everything from, you know, the fire issues to salmon to even budgetary issues that relate to fish and wildlife management resource. So I think that will help a lot also.
And you almost escaped. In addition to what John has just said, you probably are all aware of this one particular website.
No, what John just said is the lawyer has to get the last word, but that's all right.
You know, I'm accused of that at home, too. I think it also Rough and Tumble is a website that provides a really comprehensive look at California politics and also some national politics as well. So, I mean, in fact, I look at that every morning. That's not a legal opinion, just a thought.
My household does the same thing every morning on Rough and Tumble. Hard to believe that site. It's a great one.
We have one public speaker card on number 10, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Obvious, another warning. Violations have been keeping occurring. Coercion and deception. Order of the day. This is why the public trust and public confidence is so low and has been diminished. Once again, we ask, what about the past? The Attorney General was given an assignment to talk about the sea otters along the coast of California and discover the truth. They've been given many, many books of history, log books, records of early exploration and discovery along the California coast. Yet, this is another thing that the public trust and confidence has been diminished by because we are all still waiting for the report.
Thank you, Mr. Weakland.
While we're on this legal stuff, is there anything in the law that can prevent the public from deceptive stuff as well? I mean, I have said to that guy many times, you keep saying we, and I know for a fact that he's only representing himself because there's nobody else on earth stupid enough to have him represent him. So can we talk to the public about deceptiveness as well?
Y'all are keeping me on my toes this morning. That's a good question, and I do hear what you're saying and understand where you're coming from with that question. Bagley-Keene, unfortunately, within certain parameters, does allow the public to make the comments that they want to make. There's just not a good appropriate screening process in that. And we can talk about this more later offline if you'd like, Commissioner Kellogg. But I hear what you're saying.
That might be a violation.
No, I think you can talk to me.
Okay. Thank you. Gee, this is fun. Go ahead.
Item 11, further consideration and possible adoption of the draft 2009 meeting schedule. I apologize that this list did not end up in your binders. There was an oversight. We might be able to run off some copies here at this office. We're going to put it on the screen. I'm expecting right now. Oh, look at that. Oh, there we go. We had put this on the agenda for your observation at our last meeting. And just keep in mind that part of the reason we're trying to get this locked in early is we're having an increasingly difficult time getting locations and hotel arrangements and meeting site locations in California. Everybody wants to have their meeting in California, and we're finding it tougher and tougher, especially in locations like Monterey, San Diego, Tahoe City. So the other thing I want you also to realize here is this is not locked in stone. This is not – if you guys approve this today, it's not in concrete. We've made mid-course corrections in the past. Like for October, we've made that correction. We've made an adjustment from Bishop to Santa Rosa. So if you do grant this today, staff can start working on arrangements. But if for some reason we have to make a mid-course change, we can do that with proper noticing. So if there's enough caveats,
that's always going to happen because as the MLPA gets closer and closer to the adoption of the heating up of a particular area's discussions, having discussions that are in Bishop, no disrespect to Bishop, it's a very important area of the state, but we would, just like what we did now, I mean, we had to readjust that away from Bishop. So I think the public needs to understand they can't count on those away from the coastline areas when we are in the middle of very, very critical events that need to be attended by people who live along the coastline.
I did not ask the department if they had any concerns here or suggestions on this list. from a logistical standpoint, if you saw anything. We did coordinate with the department on PFMC meetings, so we didn't unnecessarily conflict with those. We also make sure we don't walk over the WAFWA meetings, and we're looking at the waterfowl adoption. I'm not sure if you had something to say.
Yeah, just a couple of brief points here. One, for scheduling purposes, we need at least 3 weeks, and we better have 4 weeks between each meeting in order to get a meeting together. So we try to set these up so that there's at least 4 weeks between each meeting, and that's one constraint we worked under. Second, salmon regulations are generally adopted in April after PFMC action occurs. So we wanted to lock that in at April 9th or 10th, roughly, is when we want to be able to do that. Third, the waterfowl regulations are generally ready from the federal perspective, and Dan will talk about that more today, right about the first part of August. So we're locked into a waterfowl meeting in early August in order to get those things into effect. The King Air, the fish and game plane, is not available in the summer for, stock, because it's stocking purposes and that, so we're trying to meet locally. There's a whole variety of things that enter in here, including holidays and things like that. So we've tried to give you the best information we can right now on it. We recognize that, and we're prepared to make some further modifications as we need to, based on MLPA or whatever. But now it would be helpful to get us kind of started on scheduling things and getting a tentative go-ahead for it.
John, I had a couple questions.
Yes.
One was in the second meeting in May. Is that an internal workshop? Is that what
That is up there as a just kind of a reminder placeholder. That is mirroring what we did this year in May when we all got together in Stockton and had our work planning meeting with the department. There was a sentiment from the commissioners to do that again. And that's on there just as a placeholder. That would not be a full regular commission meeting. If we choose to go forward with that, that would be strictly a work planning meeting with the department and commissioners, but open to the public.
You know, my only question is whether May's a good time to do that, or if we should try to tag it on to the January WAFA meeting in San Francisco, or do something in January, because we don't already have a meeting in January. My schedule gets real hectic May, June, and so I'm just wondering if there's another time of year we could do that one. The second point I'd make is that while I love being in Tahoe for Labor Day, I don't know if everybody does, so whether we want to move that at all, or if the other commissioners have any conflicts, because that is a holiday weekend.
Actually,
leading into that.
Right, good point.
So Labor Day is the weekend before.
It's the Monday following the meeting. So I'm just asking the other commissioners if they have.
I think we should consider certainly maybe moving that one back.
1 week on the September.
And basically what happens there, and that's where we kind of need to, we try to keep 4 weeks between meetings as a preference, because if there's not 4 weeks between the meeting, the turnaround for the OAL documents and APA documents gets crazy, and the department gets very upset at us. Not that that bothers me.
You're the only one here, so we can pick on you.
That doesn't change anything.
Yeah, good point. So if we did roll back the September meeting a week, we might consider rolling back October, rolling back November, that kind of thing.
I can't roll back November.
Okay. We can play around with that as staff. And
it's not a problem for me. I just was pointing it out to the other commissioners in case it's a holiday weekend for people who have other plans.
The other thing to consider is
Dan has an ongoing issue, right?
I'm looking up right now to see.
Okay.
The other thing to consider, commissioners, is there is no set in stone rule that we meet on Thursday and Friday. That is another thing to consider. That week we could have a Wednesday Thursday meeting, and then the weekend, holiday weekend would still work out. Sankey,
if the commissioners may, I wanted to follow up on Commissioner Gustafson's comment about the planning meeting. Given our earlier discussion about workload planning for the regulatory process, it probably would be beneficial to have that work planning meeting in January at the beginning of the rulemaking calendar. Kind of get the quicker we get that in order, the more effective we might be.
I agree, Sunke. That's an interesting point.
You know, if the WAFA meeting's in January in San Francisco, maybe we could, because if that's a half-day session or something, maybe we could fit that in around that and we could attend the... Okay.
There's a thought. Why don't you come in?
Yeah, another option is, could we try to keep January clear just for a lot of reasons around the holidays, and that we might consider doing the planning meeting February 4th, the date, because we're all going to be in Sacramento.
Okay.
You know, save trips. That's also something, if we can maximize
the
use of our travel, mm-hmm. Minimize travel and maximize use when you're in town. I think that still would be early enough in the planning year. Getting the head nod, that's good.
Okay.
So we'll take that under consideration. But I'd like you to think about it. I mean, I don't know if everybody would be all right with on September if we did it on the 2nd and the 3rd. So that would be a Wednesday-Thursday meeting. And then
that would be far preferable to trying to be in transit in this state on the Friday of Labor Day. My God, I mean, that's going to be really tough.
So for now,
Or even Tuesday, Wednesday.
Okay, we'll take a look at that, and Dan's looking up a conflict he might have.
Well, if we could
get back to staff on that.
How about right now? I mean, if it would be nice to get some action on this potential from the commissioners that so we could start making arrangements. If you guys think you want right now, if we could pick those dates in September. Adopt it, and then, like I say, we can make a mid-course correction on September later in the year if we need to.
But as far as I'm concerned, I like the February change. You know, leaving January open, taking an extra day in February is good. Is fine with me. The Labor Day thing is a difficult problem.
So there was an idea of Wednesday that week.
Tuesday, Wednesday would work. If you go Wednesday, Thursday, people are already starting to travel on Thursday. So things can get really dicey even then. So,
well, if all of you can do it Tuesday and Wednesday, I'm there, so you know where to find me.
Tuesday's opening day of dove season, so by God, we could...
And just a quick comment from the department. We probably would prefer middle-of-the-week meetings. Fridays are always tough.
So hard.
So we have no objection to shifting in the middle of the week.
So there's a new proposal to move them all to the middle of the week?
No, I don't want to go that far. But just, we don't have a problem if you want to move it to Tuesday, Wednesday, or Wednesday.
Let me tell you right now, I'd love middle of the week. Because
well, that's
Fridays,
a consideration for everybody.
For those of us
right
who
now.
Live where you can't get there from here, now, this meeting, I can get there from here. But everything else, I mean, as of 1 September, they've stopped the flights to Sacramento from Santa Barbara Airport. So now every meeting I'm going to get 4 hours of transport. I got to drive to Burbank and go from there. I mean, so Fridays are really tough. You get dumped down at Burbank at, you know, 6, 8 o'clock at night on a Friday afternoon. Oh, good.
You know, I agree because... We've had them on Thursday and Friday ever since I've been on this commission, and the only reason that I've had to miss some commission meetings is because they're on
exactly. Me too.
Friday of a weekend that I got other stuff conflicting with, and if we moved in the middle of the week, that would cut way down on, at least for me as a commissioner.
It would for me too.
Absolutely.
Would
I'm sorry, there's three of the five votes. We don't care what anybody else thinks.
And I just want to straighten out, do we want Tuesday, Wednesdays, or Wednesday, Thursdays, except for September? So how does this sound? How does this sound? Wednesday, Thursdays for the year, except for that Labor Day week, we'll do Tuesday, Wednesday. Can everybody live with that? That's our motion from staff.
Entire year?
Yes, sir.
It's okay with me.
That would be great.
I may miss a November meeting, but that's okay.
So I'll move.
And like second. I say, we can if we find any fatal
flaws. All those in
flaws,
favor? Shut up.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Next subject.
Dan went to the red. Oh boy.
Hey, we got three votes. Who cares? Go.
New business. I'm sorry. We had no public speakers on number 11. Number 12. New business. Any new business from any commissioners?
Any comments, questions? Nope.
You know, I just had a comment. And this is a housekeeping issue. Yesterday, when we got into the department reports, and we went on for quite a while with an excellent report on the Abilene recovery plan, it was in the updates, but I don't know that I anticipated such a long presentation. And in the future, I think items like that maybe should be on another point in the agenda and have a little forewarning, I think, for the public, too, because it was an excellent presentation, but it came kind of at the end of the day and almost as an add-on. So that would just be my suggestion.
Thank you, Cindy, for commenting on that. I was unaware that it was going to be that extensive as well.
So
and while I thought it was an incredibly important conversation, I agree with every point you made about that. So, yeah, we were a little surprised by the extent, we meaning the staff as well, were a little surprised by the extent of that conversation. It is a critical thing to be talking about. They're doing an amazing job. But having said that, I think it needs more official time.
And I might suggest that we just really look at that, because I think it's maybe misleading to the public as well, because we dealt with the halibut trawl gear there as well, and we're giving some direction. And these, I used to think, were just kind of updates from the department, nothing that we were going to necessarily give direction on or take action on. So I think it would be helpful to do.
I think that's well said, John.
Yeah. Did you hear that, Sankey? I don't think you heard the concern about the length of the abalone presentation yesterday. That probably, and I agree with commissioners, I was caught by surprise also, and apparently Sankey was too. So there was a little breakdown in staff communication between all of us. That kind of thing, I agree, should have been a standalone agenda item, especially for the length and the depth of that presentation. So they're asking that we be a little more discerning on these updates. And if it needs to be a standalone update or standalone presentation, let's calendar it that way.
Now, I don't want anyone to get the sense that we did not really want to hear that, not really value that presentation. The point is, we really value that presentation, and we believe that the public would too, and that it should be standalone and agendized.
And I think similarly, the helmet trawl gear, because here we were giving pretty significant direction on where we were headed
to a lot of people, perhaps who don't have access instantaneously to this meeting, like some people who live about a quarter of a mile from this place. So,
yeah, exactly. We were a little surprised by the breadth of the discussion under the department's informational item. That
we noticed.
Most of it was non-departmental, which we're okay with sharing. But I think in terms of notice, I did get a lot of traffic last night from the sports sector that were concerned that the commercial guys got an advantage in presenting their views without equal time. And I think I'm with Ms. Commissioner Gustafson that if we're going to have a discussion and debate about an issue or present various options, it's really more appropriate under an agenda item rather than the department's informational item. And I think we just strayed a little bit there. Information was great. No damage done. It's just if we're going to get beyond just the department presenting updates and we want some more deliberative or more inclusive discussion and debate, I agree it should probably be an agenda item.
Sankey, that's really well taken. I am so sorry, and I apologize to anyone in the public who felt that they did not have access to that discussion. That's very unfortunate, and we'll make sure that doesn't happen again.
We have one public speaker. One public speaker on this, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland, this abalone presentation was kept a secret for months and months. Many different people are asking the Abalone Association, what is their plan? What is their presentation? And yet they kept it a secret. Oh, we can't talk about it. The sport fishing industry, or the sport fishermen, have been petitioning them for months, asking them, what exactly are you going to present it? When are you going to present it? Where is it going to be presented? And we see now that it was kept a secret for, what did we say earlier, coercion and deception. These things, we did not have adequate time to respond, and now it's all over with. And it just goes to show what's happening with the abalone. It's not right. It's a deceitful. It's conniving, and you're with it all the way. We see that.
Okay, I have to make a comment. I have to make a comment. Mr. Weakland is incorrect in saying that the abalone discussion from the AG is over. That was an update yesterday. no decisions, final decisions, have been made. The abalone process is completely open. Mr. Weakland knows that. I'm very sorry that the general public is getting incorrect information.
Moving on to item 13, announcement of results from executive session. Deputy Attorney General Deborah Barnes.
Good morning. Once again, one very brief announcement. The commission did receive an executive session and update on some various security issues.
No speaker cards on number 12 or number 13. Number 14, consideration and possible approval of request to publish notice of commission intent to amend section 632, title 14, related to Morro Bay State Marine Recreational Management Area, Elkhorn Slough State Marine Reserve, and Dana Point State Marine Park. Sankey Mastrip of the department has some comments.
Real quickly, the commissioners will remember in April 13, 2007, the commission adopted the Central Coast MPAs. Since that time, we brought to your attention several technical errors that we had suggested you fix through an ISOR. One was the harbor maintenance on dredging and boat cleaning in Morro Bay. That was never intended to be prohibited. Unfortunately, the current rules, it's not clear that it's allowed, and to help enforcement and the affected parties feel more comfortable, we're recommending clarifying that. The other issue is in Elkhorn Slough State Marine Reserve, we had rounded a longitude or latitude line, and it turns out we inadvertently closed an access point, so we want to fix that. And then at Dana Point, when you changed it to a conservation area, inadvertently in the regulations, there's still a reference to a park. We just want to delete the word park so it matches its designation. And that's a quick summary of the proposed changes.
Mr. Chairman, a question,
please,
for the department. I know we have Rick Aldred is here from Morro Bay, the harbor director for Morro Bay, who I know is going to want to talk on this issue, but it seems that to address the issue of the impact of the MLPA on harbor operations, we have a couple of options. And I wanted to sort of lay them out for our consideration, and I want to hear Rick's comments as well on them. So this proposal is one option, and that is to amend the regulations relating specifically to the Morro Bay Marine Recreational Management Area to deal with the issue specifically with respect to Morro Bay. Another option would be to amend the regulations relating to all MPAs established under the authority of the MLPA that might either now or in the future impact normal and ordinary and customary harbor operations. A third option would be for the department director to issue a policy memorandum or a letter on this issue expressing the department's position that they don't intend to enforce the MLPA with respect to ordinary and customary harbor operations. A fourth option might be to seek a legal opinion from the Attorney General's office on this issue, whether the MLPA was ever intended to apply to ordinary and customary harbor operations. So that's at least four options that I can think of to deal with this issue. I actually think that the cleanest of those might be to amend the regulations with respect to all MPAs established under the MLPA that might impact harbor operations. At the moment, we only have one MPA established under the statute that impacts harbor operations. And it only, of course, this only arises where an MPA overlaps a harbor. We don't have any other examples of that except Morro Bay at the moment, but we could in the future, particularly in Southern California, excuse me, or in the far north, Humboldt Bay, for example. So we might want to deal with this now once and for all future examples of this, rather than trying to make this specific to Morro Bay. So
thank you, Commissioner Sutton, for raising that. Sankey, a question for you, and I'm sure you have a comment, too.
Quick comment, if
I
may.
Are there others that you know of that may come after Morro Bay?
I would fully expect Southern California to see one or two that end up in a similar situation. Biona Wetlands, for example,
exactly.
The outflow there is one I would suspect would be.
Right.
To quick comments on your four ideas. A overarching exemption, certainly in a regulatory sense, I love because it's simple. My only concern is I'm not so sure that all situations, Morrobay may be unique, and you may not want to grant carte blanche exemption. We'll see, because there's different kinds of dredging, and some dredging you may not want to accept at its face value. You may want to negotiate some adjustments. So that's the only caveat on the blanket exemption under MLP. Otherwise, it's a legitimate option, in my view. The letter or memo from the director is completely inadequate. We can't operate that way. There's no way to enforce it in law. And Nancy, I'm saving Nancy the trip to the podium. So that's pretty much a non-viable option. And I forgot what your fourth one was.
Well, the fourth one was to seek a legal opinion from the Attorney General's office on the applicability of this may be a non-issue to begin with. And if it is, we don't need to bother going to regulation. Just to clarify, I'm happy to go to notice on this. I just think we need to, as we move through the regulatory process, we need to refine what we intend to do. The other thing I'd love to hear more about, either from the department or from Rick and the others who want to speak, is that dredging is a federally permitted operation. And it's in that sense, it's distinct from cleaning boat bottoms and buoys and so forth. So love to hear comments on that.
Okay. So is there a...
We actually have four public speakers on, on this issue.
We do? Good.
Yes. Rick Elgert, followed by Bill Gaines, followed by Walt Manzel.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity. I am Rick Elgert, the City of Morro Bay's Harbor Director. In creating the Morro Bay State Marine Recreational Management Area, the intention throughout the MLPA process was to prohibit commercial harvest in the bay. Unfortunately, that intention was taken to technical writing of the regulations. The regulations were written to prohibit take of any living marine resource, with the exception of some very specific things, including take of recreational fin fish. I thought I might give you an example, so maybe something on the positive side before I go to the problem. You might appreciate a report on how these things work and how this can work positively, I think. The prohibition on commercial take, well, halibut fishing has been exceptional at the bay many times this year, as I've heard in some other places on the coast. In fact, a friend of mine, I think three anglers on a boat 2 weekends ago, got 7 halibut in 2.5 hours. You can imagine there's a number of part-time fishermen that hold commercial licenses, so I am confident, I'm actually sure that there would have been some commercial effort on halibut in the bay this year without these regulations. So that's the good sign of how these can work. The problem is, as the regulations were written, a smaller problem, but a problem I hope you keep in mind, is that you have prohibited other recreational activities that were never intended to be prohibited. And that would include especially something that is bothersome to us as take of a recreational take of crab, oftentimes from the pier. This is an activity that is not heavily done, but we see it, you know, 2, 3, 4 times a week right in front of our office on the pier. Often it's the low-cost or no-cost opportunity that many families have that they might not otherwise be able to recreational fish. And we have received many complaints in the office regarding this prohibition on crab take. My understanding at this point is that's considered a substantive change. And this consideration today, possibly that will have to be thrown into the management plan review for the MLPA as that comes up. But I hope you do keep that in mind. The bigger problem that we have, though, is this interpretation. Again, the regulations say that the Morro Bay State Marine Recreational Management Area prohibits take of any living marine resource with the exception of a few things, for example, recreational fin fish. It's bigger than just a concern over dredging. The best example I can give you is that we have 120 offshore moorings in Morro Bay. We require that these moorings be inspected and maintained to a standard every 2 years.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. That requires that the moorings be hauled up with a mechanical winch, with the block and tackle, and that they be inspected, and oftentimes parts of the equipment are repaired or replaced. This, by necessity, disturbs some of the marine life on the chain or the block. And you can see that that could easily be, these regulations could be interpreted as prohibiting that activity. We need to fix this. I hope your item here today is a start of a process that will complete that, so that it's clear for your enforcement folks who are right in front of us, and we have a good cooperative working relationship, and for us that that was not the intention of the creation of this MPA. Hopefully I answered, Mike, your questions, or would you like to?
Rick, thank you very much for your presentation. I'm intimately familiar with buoy operations because I have one off Santa Barbara Harbor. And every time you haul that stuff up, you are definitely going to be in violation. So this definitely has to be addressed.
Thank you.
Yes, I would hate to see the commission president arrested for scraping his boat bottom. But Rick, you know, this is on the calendar. This is our notice hearing. We're going to notice on this. We intend to deal with this through the regulatory process. I think you've answered the question right. I do draw a distinction between the issue of the impact of the MLPA on normal and ordinary customary harbor operations and the issue you brought up before, the recreational crabbing. That's an issue that was debated, as you know, at the RSG, the Regional Stakeholder Group, during the Central Coast MLPA process. And I think there's a big difference between what we're contemplating here and that kind of change, which would be reopening an activity that was discussed at length and was closed, and at least in some people's minds, intentionally. So this is what we're dealing with here are three technical changes to the regulations, which deal with unintended consequences of the regulatory actions before. And that, to me, that's we've discussed this before. That's a different category of change that we're willing to make at this stage.
Sunky, I have a question for you. Does the ISOR actually include at this point in time some of the things that we've been talking about that are not what Commissioner Sutton's talking about, like, for example, the maintenance of buoys and things of this nature?
It's rare that I find regulatory language I like, and this is an example of some I like. The two exceptions you're going to be adding if you accept this proposal ultimately is four. An exception is dredging for the purpose of harbor and channel operations and pursuant to required and valid permits and approvals. And number five, harbor operations and maintenance and cleaning of vessel hulls and other man-made structures, including removal of living marine resources for these purposes.
So that would include buoys?
Yes. It would cover anything necessary to maintain the harbor and as required by permits for navigation or whatever. It's short, sweet, but I think that gives enforcement the clarity they need, and of course the operators' assurances that they won't be cited for doing that maintenance.
Mr. Algard, I don't mean to put you on the spot, does that language answer a lot of those sorts of questions?
Yes, I've had a chance to review that previously as it was developed, and I especially like the second part with the more as a reference point, a global exception for harbor operations, I think, is appropriate. And I would add, too, I think this is a problem that you would be well-served, I think, to consider as a larger application throughout the state. I'm not going to be the only harbor with this concern.
No, you're not. Sure. And I think that's absolutely accurate. Yeah, Mr.
Yes, Sankey, I know you said something earlier about we might not want to do this on a global scale, but this language, it looks to me as though this language would be common to any harbor that would be affected by future MPA designations. Do you see a real problem in making this applicable statewide?
It's the issue of the unknown. If you would like, we could certainly draft another alternative, which would move this into a section that would make it apply to all MPAs with harbor that are around harbors. I mean, that's a feasible regulatory structure, and we could modify this to give you that option. It's just I can't speak to Hull. I mean, maybe you can speak to. I don't know if all harbors are operated and permitted the same way and do the same kinds of things under what we would call harbor operations. We know what's going on at Morro Bay. I don't know what's going on at the other San Diego.
In L.A. Harbor or something.
Yeah, and so maybe, I'm a little – the unknown makes me nervous. That's
maybe
all.
What we could do is do this for Morro Bay now, and then as and when in future MPA designations harbors are impacted or affected by an MPA, we could write this sort of language into the regs when we implement those stages of the statute.
That would be my recommendation. Is you can always clean that up if after you're finished Southern California, for example, you go, you know, we got two others, same situation. You can then just redo in that process the regulation to cover them all in a blanket.
Commissioner Richards, you have a comment?
I'm just curious why we wouldn't do it right now for all the harbors if we're going to do it for Morro Bay. Why?
Yeah, it's. I can see Sankey's point about the difference of the, like, for example, Wilmington, where you have gigantic ships coming in and out of San Francisco. There may be some issues about which we are not intimately familiar at the moment. We might miss something. I think if we did that as they come up, we'd be better
served. So I guess we would send the signal that we're certainly willing to adjust this, which I think is exactly what, you know, if we got a good ordinance or law here, then we're willing to change it and modify it as time goes on, because if appropriate issues come up, then we should do that.
The only thing I can think of in the additional harbors would be additional problems, not lesser problems.
That's right.
If we did this in all the harbors, we would cover his issues, and that would cover it for all the other harbors. Then if we had additional harbor problems that we can't see today, we make another amendment to address
that. Yeah. Adriana,
again. And today, I just want to point out that today is simply the request to publish notice.
Of course.
So we can have other folks, other harbor operations, provide input and comment in the meantime.
I think we should solicit that, actually, during this process, Sankey. In particular, I think I'd like to see, as we know, we're going to focus on San Francisco Harbor, all by itself. In addition to that, of course, San Diego has some profound issues with the Navy being there, and not to pick on the Navy, and also Los Angeles Harbor, you know, one of the most busy harbors in the world. So I think we should solicit commentary from their harbor masters and make certain that we're not running afoul.
I think Jim's comment is, and I'm seeing some concurrence. It actually may save us some time and effort, because a whole bunch of these smaller harbors, and no offense intended to smaller, may have just the same issues, so we don't have to go through all that with all of them. We've handled that, and then the larger ones or the unique ones that have something special, and then come forward with whatever that is.
What do you think, Sankey?
Well, I hate to be the contrarian, but I'm going to weigh in for a minute. That as we go through the MLPA process, this one was taken out of context because we did this and then it came to our attention. I would hope that the group studying the Blue Ribbon Task Force, as they're going through, are thinking about the issues. And maybe there are some places where in harbors we want to have some things changed and practices changed. So, or there are recommendations come out of that that say there is a more environmentally sensitive way to deal with things. I live in an area where dredging isn't easily allowed for a very good reason. So, and I'm not suggesting that this situation, the department's looked at it, they recommend this, and we move forward. But I'd hate to pass something that doesn't give us that thought process as we're going through it, to that we need to study that issue, that harbor operations are a dramatic impact on our environment. So I'm sorry to be a contrarian, but I do think there's a reason to at least call it out and have it brought to our attention each time as we go through the process.
I tend to agree with that, and that suggests that we ought to deal with this in the context of Morro Bay, and then whenever the MLPA a designation overlaps a harbor, that we deal with it on a case-by-case basis, because not all harbors are created equal. I think Rick's probably glad he's the harbor master at Morro Bay and not Long Beach, you know.
Right.
But they're very different harbors.
Cindy hit. I was going to have one last comment, and Cindy really touched on it, and that is I'm a little hesitant to preclude the work of the Blue Ribbon Task Force and the working groups. This is an issue they obviously are going to have to deal with. I would rather give them full rein to fully weigh that through, decide whether the standard application is reapplied or there may be some unique circumstance. I just don't want to preempt them. That was kind of, and Cindy kind of gave us a good example of where that may be the case. They may have approached it differently.
Thank you. That was a good.
So, would you like a motion to move?
We need
forward?
A motion. No, we're just going to
actually we have two more public speakers.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Bill Gaines, followed by Walt Manzel.
President Rogers, members of the commission, department staff, my name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. For years, this commission, in close partnership with the Department of Fish and Game, California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and the California Waterfowl Association, and members of the public down in the Morro Bay area, have fought
hard. Bill, would you get closer to the mic? I have a hard time hearing you.
It's too low, Jim. Sorry about that. For years, the Department
of
Fish and Game...
Take your shoes off, Bill.
Yeah.
It's those lifts you use.
Yeah. For years, again, the Fish and Game Commission, the Department of Fish and Game, in close partnership with the California Waterfowl Association, the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and members of the Black Brant Group have fought hard to maintain hunting opportunity in Morro Bay. I have talked to Executive Director John Carlson about whether or not there was any potential impacts from these proposed amendments on that hunting opportunity, and he did tell me that there were none. But for the record, and for the benefit of the three gentlemen from the Black Brant Group who are sitting behind me, if we could confirm that here today, I would appreciate it.
Tonky?
Unless you're hunting brant underwater, you should be okay. This should not impact in any way anything that already isn't impacted by standard harbor operations.
Assuming you don't pot them sitting on the buoys, you know, that's... Yeah.
Well, let me look at the three gentlemen behind me. Any of you guys go spearfishing for brant at all?
The barnacle hunt can proceed. Yeah, no problem.
Thank you very much.
I don't think this commission is even remotely interested in ending that or damaging that hunt.
It's a
great hunt.
You've been very supportive in the past. Thank you very much.
Walt Manzel.
President Rogers, members of the commission, Walt Manzel speaking primarily for myself. At this moment, I only ask a question, pose a question. In the various laws, is there a difference in the legal status of a recreational management area as opposed to a state marine reserve, as opposed to a state marine park, which I understand has been renamed to something else?
The answer is yes.
Yeah, there are some important differences. For example, the reason the Morro Bay State Marine Recreation Management Area is that is to allow and deal with the hunting in there. The other designations don't deal with hunting. That's why Morro Bay has that unique designation.
Thank you.
And then I can privately explain all the differences.
It's a relatively unusual circumstances. Yeah. Thank you, Sunky. Any comments? No. Okay. It's back to us, and we need a motion, I think.
Yeah, a suggested motion from staff is to authorize staff to go to notice, to request to publish notice of commission intent to amend Section 632, Morro Bay State Park Marine Recreational Management Area, Elkhorn Slough State Marine Reserve, and Dana Point.
So move. State.
Do I have it? Okay. Do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. Thank you, John. Go on. 15.
Item 15, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to subsection 29.85A2A, Title 14, related to crabs, open season. Please note the adoption hearing is scheduled for September 4th, 2008, in Kings Beach. This is a request for a receipt of public testimony. The DFG does not have a report at this time. And at this point, I have no speaker cards for this issue.
Okay.
Item 16, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 163 and 164 related to commercial herring fishery and harvesting of herring eggs on kelp. Please note the adoption hearing is scheduled for September 4th in Kings Beach.
We have a lot of crabs and herring.
This also, there is no DFG report on, oh, there is a DFG comment.
There's someone looking.
Yes, real quickly, the esteemed Mr. Mello will give you a quick reminder of what is before you relative to herring package.
Mr. Mello. My name is John Mello. I'm a senior biologist with the California Department of Fish and Game Marine Region Herring Project. And, yes, I am here to give you a brief overview of our management recommendations for the next herring season. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. Let's see. I was shown how to do this. There you have a Pacific herring. I have a couple of slides here that we could go back to if you'd like, just talking about the one on the natural history, and I also have a fisheries overview. But I thought it'd be good to get to our recommendation. The department is providing the commission the option to consider a quota within the range of 0 to 10% of the 2007-2008 spawning biomass estimate of 11,183 tons. The department is recommending a quota of for the 2008-2009 season of 1,118 tons, which is 10% of the 2007-2008 spawning biomass. A small portion of that recommendation of 1,118 tons would go to the herring eggs on kelp fishery. The proposed regulations also include adjustment to season dates and times for San Francisco and Tomales Bay to correspond to annual changes in the calendar. The date and time recommendations are decided upon after consultation with the Director's Herring Advisory Committee. The department is concerned with the status of the herring population in San Francisco Bay. However, we believe that our recommendation represents a sustainable harvest level under the current conditions. Let's see. Okay. Now we're on the right slide there, excuse me. We believe that our recommendation represents a sustainable level of harvest under the current conditions for the following reasons. A 2003 California Sea Grant administered peer review of the department's management of the fishing of the herring fishery recommended a harvest rate of 10% to sustain the population and provide a desirable target for stock rebuilding. A 20% harvest rate is considered sustainable for a stable herring population based upon computer model simulations developed by the Pacific Fisheries Management Council several years ago. In recent years, commercial landings have been far below the 10% harvest rate set by the department. Thus, it appears that environmental conditions are having a greater influence on the spawning population. We do have area closures to commercial fishing within San Francisco Bay that provide areas for herring to spawn undisturbed by fishing activity. Current bay and estuary conditions appear favorable for juvenile herring growth and survival. Preliminary results from the Young of the Year fish surveys conducted by the department are showing above average recruitment of juvenile herring for the 2007-2008 spawning season. These were recently conducted surveys. I would like to touch briefly on some other management considerations. Since the 1997-98 El Nino, the department has expressed concerns with the trend in reduced size and age structure of Pacific herring stocks coastwide. The number of herring in the spawning population remains low due to the high mortality sustained to the population in 2006. We saw a dramatic decline from a record spawning biomass during the 2006-2007 season, which was likely due to unfavorable oceanic conditions. Like delayed upwelling, which we saw during those years, and MERS impacts seen in the California salmon stocks. We are concerned about the San Francisco Bay herring spawning, the exposure of San Francisco Bay herring spawning habitats to oil from the Costco Busan oil spill, which occurred in the bay November 2007. This may lead to reduced year class strength and further delay in stock rebuilding for an already depressed stock. A Natural Resources Damage Assessment, or NRDA, survey team conducted a study of egg and larval development in oiled and non-oiled areas in San Francisco Bay. However, these results are not yet available. This was conducted during this year's herring spawning season. The findings of the NRDA report will assist in determining the immediate and long-term impact to the herring resources and, if warranted, amending the San Francisco Bay herring management strategies. We have seen improved oceanic conditions during the years 2007 and 2008, which may be beneficial for herring growth and survival and help with future stock rebuilding. Fish were heavier at length in the commercial catch this year, which is very encouraging. And recently sampled herring caught off the coast of Monterey were robust and were feeding on the abundant krill present in the area. That's another positive sign for the fishery. Lastly, we are looking at an overhaul of herring fishing regulations. Earlier this year, the department began working with the Director's Herring Advisory Committee on a plan to overhaul commercial fishing regulations. Since that time, the department has recognized the need to prepare a fishery management plan for Pacific herring. Therefore, the regulatory overhaul process will be expanded to incorporate the preparation of a fishery management plan for herring. As you know, fishery management plans contain a comprehensive environmental and economic analysis of the fishery with clear objective measures to ensure sustainability of the fishery. We will continue to work closely with the Director's Herring Advisory Committee during this expanded process. That's the end of my presentation. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, John. Any questions? Commissioner Sutton?
We, at the notice hearing, which was last month, we did not have the benefit of either your presence or Commissioner Kellogg, who bears the commission's historical memory on this issue. We were given a report that reflected record low spawning biomass of herring, possible effects of the oil spill in San Francisco Bay, and the fact that the department in the past has recommended that this fishery be closed. And so we asked for the option to do that this year. But I wanted to hear from you and from Commissioner Kellogg as to why we shouldn't take that action, given the signs that this fishery is in trouble, at least this year. It may be improving in the future, but we asked for the flexibility to close the fishery if it was warranted. But we didn't want to take that recommended action until we heard from
Commissioner Kellogg. You want to weigh in?
Yeah, I'll just for a little brief history. This commission has learned a lot about the herring fishery in San Francisco Bay. How the biomass is counted, how nets are measured. We changed the size of the nets over the years. But the one thing that we've learned continuously is that fishery changes and up and down every year. And like you said, the past year they couldn't even fill the quota. But that being said, the department has made some huge changes in the way that they work with the fishery and the people involved in the fishery. They have the Herring Advisory Committee that's appointed by the director of the department. Sonke has worked very close with that fishery, and things have improved, not just 100%, but 400 or 500% over the way they were a few years back. Because of some of the reactions of those low numbers at one point, there was a recommendation to totally close that fishery because one year there was low biomass count. What ended up happening was the way they were collecting the biomass count and the fishermen involvement wasn't being considered, and so they weren't getting accurate counts of the biomass on the herring fishery. Secretary Chrisman was on the commission during those days, and we were able to override the recommendation to close that fishery. The following year, they had the biggest abundance of herring that they'd ever had since in the history of them keeping count. My comments today are mostly about how well the department and the biologists are working with the fishermen in that fishery, and from what I understand, they totally support the recommendations of the department for the upcoming season. And the only thing that I would ask, I hope that when you're collecting the biomass information, that you're reaching out to the fishermen and getting their ideas on where and how you should do that. Because we had such issues over this that we were even arguing about they couldn't dive into kelp to get the real biomass counts because of the tide and about them doing it on slack tides and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of history to this fishery. I can tell you as somebody who sat through all of that I'm very comfortable with them having a season, Commissioner Sutton, because I believe that they're working together, and the fishermen will be the first ones to tell us if there's a real serious problem. They don't want to put themselves out of business, and they would shut it down for a year themselves before they would do that. So
that's really helpful. I was alarmed at the traditional signs of trouble in a fishery: record low spawning biomass, the fact that the fishermen can't even catch the quota that we give them. All of that in an ordinary fishery would suggest that it's in real trouble. However, this is a small pelagic; it's variable, highly variable by nature. And there's a lot of history here, and so I recognize that. And in fact, we have had letters from some herring fishermen suggesting that the fishery be closed. So I didn't know quite what to think, and history is really helpful.
That came into play as well. You have a little bit of fishing jealousy there. There's a group of fishermen that fish down in Morro Bay and Monterey Bay, and a group that fish up, and there's personality conflicts. We get those letters every year, Mike.
Any further questions?
I just have a question, not on the approval or disapproval, but I'm curious. You mentioned there are areas within the bay where no fishing is allowed so that the herring can spawn and in safety. What happens if someone fishes there? Commercial fisherman fishes there. What's the penalty? Who's supervising it, and what's the penalty?
Well, the majority of these areas are under the jurisdiction of the National Park Service that I'm aware of, that it would be their regulations that would be violated. But I could find that information and get that to you.
Yeah, we do actually have some of the closure areas are not under federal jurisdiction. Probably have Nancy speak to the enforcement aspect since she deals with it. There's a long enforcement history with the herring fishery, and it's quite convoluted. Nancy, can you give them
a brief overview
of that?
Any violation would be a misdemeanor offense, and depending on the county where the violation actually occurred, that would be the county where it would be filed. So it would be a fine or penalty up to $1,000 and 6 months in jail.
Have we ever put anybody in jail for it?
Not in San Francisco County. I don't believe in Marin County. You know, a long time ago when herring was a big fishery, there were herring wars. I mean, people were shooting each other over herring fisheries. The way the fishery is right now, it's much, much different. The fishermen are very professional and are trying to adhere to the laws as we know them. But we don't have, if there is an issue and there's a citation that's written or a formal complaint, it's $0 to $1,000 in the county where the activity occurred.
And it's a misdemeanor.
Thank you.
Any further questions or comments?
I had one real comment, just as a matter of fact, and you may hear some testimony. Part of the reason the fishermen didn't catch the quota, and they haven't done that for a while actually, is the market has really changed, and there's no demand like it used to be, and there's literally more quota than there is demand by the market, and that's one of the things that's spawned us to look at overhauling the fishery to make it easier for the fishermen to operate, because the market's really tough for them, although I hear some signs lately that it's improving. But just so you look at that, part of the reason they're not catching quota is not necessarily lack of fish. There's no buyers or no demand.
Well, speaking of the fishermen, I think it's probably time for public comment. We do have a public commentary.
Sam Liberati.
Sam, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Sam Liberati. I'm on the Herring Fishermen's Advisory Committee. I'm the new chairman. I came here to compliment these biologists, and that's surely a change from the past. We've got some good people managing the fishery now. We've got great biologists in San Francisco. If you talk to any of the advisors on the Herring Commission, they're really satisfied with the department. And because of that, we're trying to establish a relationship, which we have established, really, to work together. We have a lot of we have a lot of things in our regulations that are so outdated that it's time to start changing them and bringing them up to date. We're positive that we could cut a lot of things out there to save costs to the department and also to the fishermen. But the question was brought up now on the biomass, and that's the one thing that we don't agree with the department on how the biomass numbers are taken. Years ago, they would take the acoustical surveys and the herring spawn and take the two and average them together. That's how they came up with a number. We cut our gear down 50% because we thought we could catch the quota, which we did, with half the gear that we were using, because the fishermen were concerned about putting too much gear in the water. And believe me when I say that the fishermen are more concerned than anyone on the biomass numbers. And we don't want to see those numbers go down. Now, when they took the average of the two ways of coming up with the biomass numbers, the fishing game had junk equipment. I mean, they had a boat that was never running, and it was hard for them to get the proper surveys. So I went to Sacramento, and I think I brought this up before, and asked for a herring stamp. And that money was to be dedicated strictly for the research, buy these guys a new boat, and do what we had to get proper surveys. Now, since that time, we've had, I'm sure you older commissioners realize, we've had a lot of bumping heads with the department, which today I'm really happy because that's gone. But anyway, they started taking their surveys. They had a peer review in which we were supposed to be involved. We were not involved. And now the goals that they use is to take the spawn surveys. Well, those have always been low. And the acoustical surveys were always high. So what the department did, they averaged it too. So that makes a big difference in the numbers you have today and the numbers you had then. And a lot of fish, we know for a fact, spawn in the deep water, and I'm sure John will agree to that. And when you take spawn deposition, you're really not getting those numbers. But anyway, I guess the positive thing is I look for next year coming before this commission with a lot of good things to say, because we have an advisory committee now that has a lot of old-time fishermen that have a lot of knowledge, and we have the department who we could sit down and talk to, and they will listen. I know the advisory committee has a lot of confidence in these people, so I look for good things to happen.
Thank you for your remarks, Sam. Any questions or comments from the commission?
Thank you.
Good to see you.
This is the only public speaker card I had for item 16 was Sam.
17,
commission recognition of newly inducted members to the Waterfowlers Hall of Fame. I would like to invite Bill Gaines. Is Bill Gaines in the room?
Yeah.
There he is. He's hiding behind the camouflage hat. Okay. I'd like to have him come up to the microphone, give a little introduction and explanation of this commission recognition, some background from the Waterfallers Hall of Fame perspective. Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Again, President Rogers, member of the commission, department staff. My name is Bill Gaines, and I am president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and I'll try to stay close to this mic. It's a little bit difficult. I didn't take my shoes off as recommended, though, but so
you
I
know,
still have my shoes
I
on.
Think, hey, you guys on the machines, can you just turn that mic up? Because it's not just Bill. It's in the next issue after this, I want to be able to hear everything from Paraguay.
Go around here.
Gary.
Paraquat.
Dan, is that a little better?
YP, we just call it
YP. Is that better?
Yeah.
A little better? Okay. I am a proud member of the California Waterfowlers Hall of Fame Induction Committee. Serving with me on that committee is John Carlson from the Fish and Game Commission. We also have Dan Perry-Gary from the Department of Fish and Game, representatives from the California Waterfowl Association, as well as Ducks Unlimited, and a variety of individuals who have played an important role throughout the waterfowl conservation effort over the course of the last several decades, including Red Hunt, past Department of Fish and Game employee, Ray Lewis, who is well-known among waterfowl circles, and G. Ray Arnett, who has also held many important positions with both state and federal agencies dealing with resources. Roughly about three-quarters of a century ago, the staggering loss of waterfowl habitat here in California and nationwide and the resulting alarming drops in waterfowl populations led the sportsmen throughout the nation and in California and the resource agencies to unite in an unprecedented waterfowl conservation effort. Not only did that create to the creation of, or lead to the creation of Ducks Unlimited in 1937, but also the creation of California Waterfowl Association just a few years later in 1945. You know, today, 75 years later, we have done a remarkable, we as a team, the public and private partnership, has done a remarkable job of restoring waterfowl habitat in California and throughout the continental United States. We've put back on the ground tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres of waterfowl habitat in California alone, either through restoration or enhancement. And today we do enjoy relatively robust waterfowl populations, as well as other birds that depend upon the same habitats and wetlands that waterfowl depend upon. The intent of the California Waterfowlers Hall of Fame is to recognize those key individuals who, over the course of the last three quarters of a century, have played a lead role in our waterfowl conservation effort here in California. We're losing them daily, literally, as they become older and they leave us. We want to recognize them for all they've done in leading us to where we are today and hopefully setting the stage for the future of that waterfowl conservation effort here in California. As such, the inductee committee over the course of the last several months has met several times. This is the third class of inductees that has been brought forward in front of this Fish and Game Commission, and we're proud to bring forward the individuals that we're bringing forward today for your consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Commissioners, thank you, Bill. Commissioners, I would like to read into the record just a brief description of the inductees, if you'll indulge me. We have just a handful. Mr. A. Wendell Miller, and he is being recognized because his extensive work with waterfowl throughout his career as a wildlife biologist with the Soil Conservation Service and later as a private consultant on marsh management. This is a great recognition for Mr. Miller. Mr. Kenneth H. Hoffman. Mr. Hoffman is being recognized for his lifelong support of waterfowl and waterfowl habitat and his leadership in pursuing good biological knowledge of waterfowl and restoring and protecting key habitats. His philanthropic giving for flyway and continental waterfowl issues, including donating over $5 million to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and Ducks Unlimited to support Valley Care, which focuses on restoration of habitats in Central Valley. Mr. James C. Bartnick. Dr. James C. Bartnick. Dr. Bartnick For his 31 years of service with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service dedicated to migratory bird management and research, including the establishment of the first migratory bird research station in Alaska, and an area of importance to many species of waterfowl that winter in California. His efforts led to over 40 scientific publications on the pelagic seabirds, diving ducks, and other birds. His widespread expertise used in the development of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act with Russia and his participation in international bird research with England, Japan, and Mexico. Mr. Ray Lewis. Mr. Ray Lewis, for his participation and involvement in waterfowl, wetland conservation, and duck hunting issues for over 50 years, and for participation in organizations such as Ducks Unlimited, California Waterfowl Association, National Wild Turkey Federation, the Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy, and the National Rifle Association. And Ray is still very active. I was at a committee meeting with him earlier this week, he is still very active. Mr. David D. Bohannon. The Commission recognizes Mr. Bohannon for his genius in real estate and land development and as a true sportsman who loved hunting and fishing several oceans and leading several safaris to Africa, whose true calling was in wing shooting, especially ducks that migrated in California. His commitment to improving habitat helped start the San Mateo Ducks Unlimited chapter to raise funds, significant funds for habitat protection and restoration. Those are this year's inductees to the Waterfowl Hall of Fame.
Thank you, John.
We have no further public speakers on that.
Nope.
Moving on to item 18, consideration of certification of final environmental document, adoption of findings and proposed project or alternative, and possible adoption of the 2008-2009 migratory waterfowl regulations.
I'm going to do the same thing.
We have Dan Perigary from the department who's out of the room for some reason.
I'll go get him.
Working on his golf swing, no doubt.
No, I wasn't.
But I'm sorry, I was talking Brant stuff.
I'm not leaving because you're coming.
That's fine. I do have a PowerPoint that we'll set up, but are we ready to go here, John? I'm sorry, I was slightly distracted.
We are ready when you're ready.
I'm
That's right. You got here early today, too, and you're still distracted, man.
Well, it doesn't take much to distract me, as you well know. Following up on some of the summary information we provided the commission at the last meeting in June, I guess it was, we now have the federal frameworks and some other numbers and stuff in, so I'm going to present the department's recommendations relative to waterfowl hunting seasons this year. To kind of cut to the chase a little bit, where our basic regulation changes are relatively small, one of which is of note, we're proposing to reduce the hen daily bag limit from 2 to 1. There's been some changes in how scop harvest management is done in this country. The federal frameworks have changed, requiring us to have no more than an 86-day season for scop and a two-bird daily bag. That does create some potential complications in our regulations for you. And this is almost embarrassing after the extra work we asked you to go through last year relative to the canvasback season. If you remember, our eyesore last year did not include a two-bird daily bag. The population grew dramatically. The service changed the framework, which was unanticipated by us. We ended up having to go to notice, do a subsequent environmental document, and after doing that, the canvasback population dropped 44% this year, and that same strategy that allows for two last year calls for a close season this year. We can talk about that for just a second. We do have some very good news on the goose front, and our recommendation is to increase the bag limit in most zones from 6 to 8 per day and increase the white goose limit up to 6, while maintaining the other species-specific limits. A little bit of micro detail for you, though. We are proposing a Imperial County late season for white geese to address depredation concerns down around the lower Salton Sea. So those are the changes. And so if you're familiar with the regs last year, that's really all we're talking about changing, although we do have some specifics for you to consider. In the initial statement of reasons, these were the alternatives presented in that ISOR. Just so you know that it included a range of of duck seasons from 38 to 107, which is the maximum allowable under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Bag limit ranges from 3 to 7 for mallards, 1 to 2 hen mallards. We had a range of 0 to 7 pintails just for completeness, although the federal frameworks and the harvest strategy allow only one pintail in the bag, so that's your maximum choice there. And as I said, canvasbacks are closed in the federal framework, and the SCOP daily bag limit is reduced to 2 in the federal framework. On the goose front, the ISOR included alternatives of 4 to day, 4 to 8 per day for geese, up to 6 white geese. No changes in the other species and populations that are regulated under our waterfowl regs. We didn't even have the status video. For those of you last year remembered, I think you enjoyed seeing the status video. It just showed up yesterday, so it's available if anybody is interested in it. But I thought I'd quickly summarize the status of ducks. At the last meeting, we talked about western mallards, which is the basis for our duck harvest frameworks now. And those ducks are down 14% compared to last year and 14% below their long-term average. So in California, as we shared with you at the last meeting, local mallards are down, and they're down below their long-term average. In total, though, the other duck species that breed in California are also down, but they're kind of similar to their long-term average. If you look at the mid-continent, that's what that mid-con stands for. So all the species that come to us from the mid-continent region, including Alaska, they're down from last year, but still above their long-term average. And I think as you go through the chart, green-winged teal are particularly important to our harvest in our state. They're similar to last year and still in a very good status. Widgeon are similar and still slightly below. You see pintail continue to be a problem child. They're below last year and quite far below their long-term average. Gadwall are down compared to last year, but up over their long-term average. It's kind of hidden here in the red, but the canvasback are down 44% compared to last year and down 15%. And scop and redhead numbers are there as well. And I think the easiest way to think about this is that generally ducks are kind of so-so average. When you compare them to their long-term average, they're all down from last year. The prairies were very dry this year.
Dan, that SCOP number, is that greater and lesser lumped together? Or?
Yes, because during the air surveys, you can't differentiate them. Right. So it is SCOP combined.
Thank you.
The goose situation, however, is much better. My attempt at making it simple for me to understand, red numbers are generally below the population goals for them, and green are above. So walking through that PP is what we call the Pacific population Canada goose. These are the honkers that nest traditionally in northeastern California. They're below their management goal. Rocky Mountain population Canada geese are geese that come to us primarily in southern California in winter. Those come from Utah, Colorado to some extent in the Rocky Mountain area. Cackling Canada geese are a small form that breed on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta in Alaska. They no longer come to California in very big numbers. They're pretty well short-stopped in Washington and Oregon. They're making some progress toward their goal, but from there on, things are much brighter. Aleutian Canada geese doing quite well. Black Brant are not at their goal. They're in the green because the flyway plan would have allowed some liberalization. We talked about that briefly at the last meeting, and that at that time, fox predation on the YK was high this year, and at that time back in June, the forecast was for very poor production of brant. The initial statement had, following the management plan, a proposal for liberalization, and at the last meeting, I suggested we might retract that. The flyway council considered all that, and in essence, the frameworks did not change, so the proposal that's in your ISOR to double the bag limit has not been reflected in the federal frameworks, and that's in response to a very poor nesting year in Alaska. Pacific white fronts, look for us to be coming to the table next year after we do some necessary coordination with Alaska natives and other states. We're actually at our harvest strategy thresholds, but we need to amend our harvest strategy because it's not keeping up with these guys. That's kind of the good news. We continue to work on tule white fronts. We've talked about that a little bit before. Snow geese from Wrangel Island, Russia, are above their objective. Western Canadian Arctic snow geese, that is from the Banks Island area, are also doing very well. And, of course, Ross geese from the Queen Maud Gulf are through the roof. So those white goose combinations are the basis for our liberalization, basically. Adaptive harvest management, as we talked at the last meeting, for us, our frameworks are now set based on the status of western mallards, the ones that are down 14%. But based on computer modeling, which considers things like growth rate and things like harvest rate and the effect of regulations on harvest rate. The optimum package for this year is 107-day season, the max allowed under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, up to 7 ducks in total, up to 7 mallards, up to 2 hens. Seasons can't start any earlier than Saturday nearest September 24th, nor close any later than the last Sunday in January. So that is your framework. But as I said in the first slide, the department's recommending a lower hen bag limit for mallards this year. And that is a deviation then from the Western Mallard AHM, i.e. our best science says that 7 ducks, 7 mallards, 2 hens is the appropriate bag limit. However, that Western Mallard model, that stuff that is an aggregate stock, it considers the status of Oregon mallards, it considers the status of Alaska mallards, it considers the status of California mallards as well. However, In our view anyway, not well enough. Our mallard stock is low. It's at our second lowest level. We have very poor nesting conditions in California this year and for the second consecutive year. And so we're suggesting that we adopt a slightly lower bag limit for females. And a lot of folks will ask, you know, how can that possibly matter? You're going from 2 to 1. But the best analyses do suggest that we can affect hen survival rates with bag limit changes even as low as that. Whereas that's not true in terms of total mallard harvest. And there are some recommendations in front of you from the public for more restrictive bag limits on mallards due to the status of our local ducks. So I wanted to spend a second and talk about that last bullet for you.
Dan, on those numbers that you showed up there on the decline of the duck populations, are you comfortable with those?
Well, you know, all of our surveys...
I'm referring to pretty much just one because... other than Bill Gaines, I don't think anybody else shoots shovelers, and they were down. So,
yeah, you Bill know, when Mr. Flores left the commission, it kind of my target is now behind me. Yeah, I mean, you know, the survey methodology, as you know, I participated this year, is very rigorous, and it's real because, you know, the prairies were dry. The prairies were dry, and our local duck stocks, our numbers are down. Well, we expected that because last year we had dry spring in California. So, you know, I don't know. It was really interesting listening to the discussion on herring spawn because it's really we had similar issues except that we can see our critters and we don't have to use sonar to try and guess how many there are. So as an index, as a change, we've been doing these surveys for a long time, so we're pretty comfortable that these changes are real. So I did want to talk for a second, though, about this hen mallard thing. It's mostly because there is, you know, some stuff on your record relative to a lower bag limit for mallards. And this is a nice, pretty model-based graph. And so as a result, it's for the whole flyway as a whole. And the best way to look at this is that the daily bag limit on the lower axis at the left is 7. And if you reduce the bag limit to 0 all the way to the right, you should affect 100% reduction in harvest. You've closed the season. And the incremental changes then as you go from 7 to 6, from 6 to 5, from 5 to 4, are much less until you get down into these lower bag limit sizes. And the reason for that is very simple. Most people do not achieve the daily bag limit every day. So reducing the bag limit on mallards from 7 to 5, this model thing, which smooths it all out and makes it look real nice and predictable, suggests that you might see as much as a 5% change in total mallard harvest. It's different for hens, though, that green triangle, where you would expect to see something more like a 20% decline in hen harvest. And that's starting to get up into that area where you are going to make a difference, perhaps. But that's a model-based thing. It smoothed the curve out really nicely, and I can see that I'm going to have to start using different colors here. The hard-to-see red dashed line corresponds to the right axis, which is the daily bag limit for mallards. It's ranged between 7 and as low as 3. The green line, which is somewhat easier to see, is the daily mallard harvest in California. And you can see that it averages about 3,000 mallards a day, whether the bag limit's 7 or the bag limit's 3. You know, so what that implies, obviously, is that the main controlling force on duck harvest is season length. And lastly, I wanted to call your attention to the last little bit of that graph, which you can see that there are some, you know, non-intuitive changes. Season length went down, or bag went up, or daily bag went up. Bag limit stayed the same, or harvest went down. Because the primary drivers of duck harvest are really recruitment. When we have a good fall crop of ducks, we shoot a lot more ducks. Hunter activity and success, which are driven by weather and competing recreational needs. Season bag and then season length is the next driver. And the last thing that really affects duck harvest is the bag limit. And so those are the reasons behind the department's recommendation to maintain a 7-bird bag, because most ducks are okay. Changing the mallard bag is really going to be inconsequential in total. However, we do have enough evidence to believe that reducing the hen mallard bag will have a significant improvement in hen survival into the next nesting season. So that's why we're deviating from the Western AHM stuff, which is the quote-unquote best science available. So then to summarize and wrap back up then, our statewide, except for Colorado River, we're recommending a 7 mallard bag limit with one hen. The pintail is constrained by the federal frameworks to 1, as is the scop limit of 2, as is the closed canvas back season. We are recommending going to 8 per day for geese. These will be some of the most liberal, well, these are the most liberal goose seasons we've ever had in our state. They're 100 or so days long, 8 geese in total, up to 6 whites. These are as good as it's been in a long time. And as I, again, for a heads up, I look for us, given the status of white fronts, to be working with the natives and the other states to amend our planning documents, and we're very likely to come forward next year with an even greater increase on white-fronted geese. There's basically no changes for the most part in our season length recommendations. They vary by zone. So in essence, those are no change. The one change I did want to highlight here is the somewhat bolded one for that white goose in Imperial County Special Management Area. We proposed a general season from November 1st to the 25th. Now, remember that the frameworks don't allow any more than 107 days hunting in total. So when the agricultural interest came forward and said, you know, we'd like to use hunting as a tool, well, it had to come from somewhere. The good news for those folks is they don't see very white geese down there in October. So it's really, we're not taking anything away from them. Just like the hunt we have on the North Coast, the proposal here is to allow the hunting to occur on private lands only. Now, that we've been doing that on the North Coast, and it has been, I believe, if you talk with the agricultural interests up there and the hunting public, very popular. And one of the reasons it's been popular is because our good friends at COA and CWA have arranged access programs working with the landowners to get the unattached public hunter there. And with speaking with one of the main movers and shakers from Imperial County, he's been talking with the growers down there, and they are interested and willing to consider that continuation of that down in the southern part of the state. And I think that makes it a win-win deal. I know we've got some brant hunters here, and I know they know as much about what's going on as I do, but just to be clear, the frameworks are the same as they were last year, so there's no change for that. 30 days, same 30, 2-bird bag, daily bag. No change in our recommendation for the youth hunts. Northeastern California would be prior to the season for 2 days, and everywhere else 1 week after. I mentioned earlier the scop and canvasback thing, and I thought I would touch on the canvasback thing just a second, so excuse this blurry slide that's about to show up here. Those colored areas are the standard errors around the estimates, and all I wanted to show you here is that the estimates of canvasback have a history of going wacky on us. They drop, they rise, they drop, they rise. The strategy, though, is isn't responding to that at all. It just uses the current year's breeding population estimate in combination with the current year's habitat and says this is the allowable harvest. And when the allowable harvest isn't great enough to sustain even a 60-day season, the service closes the season. So I guess, you know, my take of that, if the conditions are at all normal or approaching normal in the prairies next year, that number is going to go right back up again. So it's very tough on the hunters, and we think that there's maybe some consideration needs to be worked into these strategies to where they don't do that. Closed, man, it's crazy. I wanted to go through this. These are the last few slides on a zone. As again, most of these are no changes from last year. There's a slight change here. We've traditionally opened this zone on the first Saturday. We're recommending the second Saturday. There's two reasons for that, mostly associated with A, the calendar progression stuff. The first Saturday would make it the fourth. If you have your youth hunt 2 weeks earlier, it's going to be pretty much mid-September. There's a very late hatch going on in northeastern California and southern Oregon, and we'd be sending these kids out there. It'd be like shooting ducks in Alaska. Most of them aren't even flying yet. So that's one of the reasons for moving that back. But There is some choices that, that can be made. Our recommendations on where to put the 86 days for scop. We put them based on our harvest stuff. We know when scop harvest generally occurs in counties. It's not intended to target scop harvest, but there's no reason to have the season closed when the birds aren't there. When you think about it, it's as much protection for the hunters as it is. You want them to have an open season when they've got a chance to shoot a scop. It's just that simple. So in Northeast, we're recommending the first 86. And then the other wrinkle on this is this recommendation for Southern San Joaquin, it matches what the Tulare Basin Wetlands Association has recommended for years. It's no change. But with that scop season, our best look at scop harvest is that they don't hardly see any scop down there in October. They've only got 7 days left over. So it would make their regs awfully complicated to have ducks open on the 4th, scop open for 7 days, ducks closed on the 26th. And Art Spaulding from the Tulare Basin Wetlands Association was at CWA's meeting last week. They were okay, at least Art was okay with this notion that they're kind of giving up 7 days of protection from accidentally shooting a scop is about what this amounts to. But it does make their regs simpler. And after that, Colorado River, our regs are required by federal frameworks to match what Arizona selected. This is what they selected, which is essentially no change. And we're proposing the same thing with scop in the other zones of California to put it at the last 86, because although scop harvest does occur in the balance of state zone, Southern California zone, in October it's very small and relatively inconsequential. So to try and protect those folks that big open water hunters that want to go out for scop, we want to put it when they can get them.
Dan, why in Southern California is the duck season, why the 100 days instead of 105 like up north?
Well, remember that the framework date, that yellow thing on the top, that's as late as you can go.
Right.
So we have not had any real interest or recommendation from folks to start their seasons any earlier. Unlike the Tulare Basin, you know, that Southern San Joaquin zone, mm-hmm. where those folks have come to us and said, we think there's opportunity here, that's pretty early. There's not much migration of ducks that far south that time of the year.
I actually agree with that, that there's not much migration, but it just seems so much simpler. Why wouldn't we be opening them all at the same time and giving them the same opportunity? And
actually, Dan,
yeah, well,
we've had years in the past where they've come, the people from down there have come and asked to be opened later.
Other 5 days would cause you to open on a Monday, and right, because you run out of days. If you the two youth days count against the 107 total.
Okay.
So if you added the 5 days here, their season would open on a Monday, which is non-traditional. And as Commissioner Kellogg just said, unlike Northeast, which ends like on a Tuesday, if I recall right, the hunters from Northeast have said that's fine. There's very few guys hunting there in mid to late January, and if they can hunt on a Monday or a Tuesday, we're fine with that. We want that. We want to do that. Nobody's come to us and made that recommendation. It's consistent with our past practices of seasons open on Saturdays and close on Sundays. I actually think you'll get some resistance to a Monday opener for the fellows that can't get out on a Saturday, you know, on a Monday. They got to do their day job. So that's why that's 100 days. And, again, we talked about that, and we talked about that. And am I going the wrong way? There's too many buttons. And again, the balance of state is kind of the same thing. October, early October, while there's ducks showing up in the valley for certain, a Monday opener is just, you know, there's not much going on there. But I always want to call attention to that white front season. Right in the middle of some of the best white front hunting, period-wise and geographically, we have a short season with a smaller bag limit, and that's all about those Thule white fronts that we've talked to you about before. So the Brandt thing for you guys, that's no change. For the Southern thing is the second Saturday in November, and Northern is the first. And so no change there. And that was the tedious detail that I felt I needed to present to you today.
Thank you, Dan.
Any questions?
We got public
comment. Yep. Yes, we have four public speakers, so there might be more questions after that, Dan. Fred Harpster, followed by Walt Manzel, followed by Greg Yaris, and then Bill Gaines.
Hi, my name's Fred Harpster from Morro Bay, California. Commissioners, just a few things that I wanted to bring up. Talking about Morro Bay, no violations, no accidents. Everything went very well there this year. Mr. Rogers last year said that we should probably get a little bit more community involved. So we took and went out, and we got an Eagle Scout, and he had an Eagle Scout project, and we had him build a kiosk for us that we can put a sign in that is going to show the boundaries for the state park, Morro Bay, and the fish and game areas, tell a little bit about the laws of the hunting in Morro Bay. We also used a bunch of Boy Scouts for our dinner, hired them, and so that we could use them a little bit. We donated some money to the Morro Bay Harbor Festival. And anyway, that was kind of our community work this year so far, and we're still looking for more things to do and stuff. So,
Fred, where is that kiosk?
It's going to be right at the main launch ramp in Morro Bay, and it is up and running. We do not have the sign in it yet. We're still getting some artwork done for it and stuff like that. So.
Good, thank you.
And it came out very nice, so I'm sure it'll be a
Fred, thanks so much for all your efforts down there. I know it was pretty contentious a couple of years ago, but obviously people are working together down there, and you guys are making great strides in outreach, so really appreciate it.
Well, we're working hard at it. So
probably had kayakers help you put the sign up. Huh?
Anyway,
I must admit I heard some of the most astonishing public comment about that I think in my entire history on this commission I've ever heard. It was completely inflammatory and totally off the mark, but it was there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for being in Carpinteria and not in Morro Bay.
I'm very thankful to be down here.
I'm glad to drive down. To go on a little bit with Danny, was, you know, we were talking about the Brant limits and the numbers up and everything else, and we understood that, and we have no problem with staying with our same limit and our same season. That's great. What we would like to do is we'd like to try to get to the Flyway Council and lengthen our season opportunity for, say, another 30 days. We have to close by December 15th, and we'd like to get 15 to 30 days more as an opportunity so that when it's possible, we can get more hunter opportunity. Instead of more birds, we'd like to get more hunters the opportunity to go. So anyway, we would hope that somehow we can get to them and start working with that to lengthen that if possible. And that's all I have to say about Morro Bay. I'd like to talk a little bit about the season. I come down here to campaign for... Can I go? I come down here to campaign for an October 11th season in the Northeast, which I don't have to campaign because I see that's being asked for, so that's great. And it was mostly because of brown birds. Bird identification and hen mallards, now that you're saying maybe one. So I'd like to... say, hey, you know, that's why I'd like to have a lengthened season later, because we can tell the bird better. I mean, it's very hard for a seasoned veteran to tell hen mallards early in the season compared to greenheads. So anyway, that was my campaign for that to come down here a little bit more. I only have one other question, and that was when Dan said that we're going to the junior seasons are going to be in the Northeast in the early and in the rest of the state in the late. And, you know, we're sending our youth out in September, mid-September, to shoot ducks when a seasoned veteran can't tell what he's shooting. You might tell by the shape of the bird, but you're sure not going to tell by the color of him. And I just have that question. I don't know how to go about fixing that, but I don't think it's doing a real educational help for these kids. We're letting them shoot some birds, but are we really teaching them what we need to be teaching them? Anyway, I wanted to bring that up. And I guess I'm done.
Thank you, Fred. Dan, do you want to comment a little bit on some of the questions that Fred had? Thank you, Fred.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. Well, the Brant one, I think we could spend an awful lot of time talking about, but the Flyway Management Plan has a population goal and intermediate thresholds on when regulations should be constrained or liberalized. And
at the 135 number that we're at, which is based on a three-year average of the midwinter index, we can liberalize. And what the plan says is 2X, double your harvest, and which is the basis behind our recommendation for a change in bag limit. We've heard from Fred and others that first off, that may be a record brand. I never did go check that, Fred, to see if that's true, that we've never had a bag limit as high as that on brand.
Three has been five.
Okay, yeah, I think that's right. And the other part of the flyway plan, though, that I think is going to be the rub here, the Black Brant Management Plan was the first plan written in our flyway, and one of its objectives was not just to achieve a population size, but to achieve a population distribution. When that plan was written, the midwinter index for Brant in California was nearly zero. Birds were shooting right by us going down to Mexico, where land use decisions and a lot of other things were certainly far and away out of our limited control. The plan has bay-specific wintering objectives. It says we are going to go by memory here, so these might not be exactly precise. But my recollection is for Morro Bay, the midwinter objective is 3,000. For Tomales Bay, it's 2,000. And for Humboldt Bay, the winter objective is 5,000. And what we've learned in the recent year, and so after those flyway or those bay-specific objectives were set, and at that time our Brant season in California was in February. And based on research that was done at Humboldt State, not Davis, there goes my pay increase.
You know, that is coming. That is never let go of.
It was found that those February seasons were targeting primarily adult birds that were the first to migrate on the way up and kind of not the birds you really want to be shooting. And so we switched to a fall season. We switched from a February season to a November 1 to 30 season. And as a result, the midwinter index indices in all of our bays started to increase, and particularly Humboldt, where it was literally zero for a number of years. And as Fred will remember, we went November 1 to 30 from about 1984 to about 1998, 99, somewhere in there. And then the fellows, and we had one statewide season for Brant, and sea kayakers and other recreational uses were conflicting with the Brant hunting in Morro Bay. They asked to move the season start a little later and run a little later, thinking that a lot of the recreational folks wouldn't be on the bay once December came and things got a little more rugged weather-wise. We did that statewide, and as a result, our midwinter index in Humboldt Bay dropped. So when we hit the next threshold in the Brant plan 2 or 3 years ago, which called for a halving of our harvest, we cut our seasons down to 15 days. We went to the service then and made the pitch for a zoning for Brant, which they hadn't allowed us to do before, because we knew that the 15 days that would maximize their opportunity in Morro Bay were not anywhere near the ones that would maximize the hunting in Humboldt Bay. And that was so we started going later into December in Humboldt Bay, and the midwinter index dropped. Now, this is not a cause and effect. This is not the best science, but we've seen that relationship. So we have to meet two goals here, which is not just the overall population size, but we're committed to this flyway plan of returning population objectives. In Morro Bay and Tomales Bay, they're at their population objectives, and longer seasons or higher bags or however we choose to implement them are our choice. The plan doesn't stipulate how to double your harvest. It just says do it. However, we're going to continue to fight that, and it would be a kind of a major policy goal at Humboldt Bay, since we don't understand the relationship between season timing and the resulting changes in the midwinter index. But that is our goal. Our goal is to get Brant to 5,000 at Humboldt Bay as measured by the midwinter survey, and we have moved from zero to very close, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. I mean, it's not a huge number of birds, but when you consider our goal was 5,000 and we started at zero, we're making progress toward it. And every time we step away from a November 30th ending date at Humboldt Bay, our seasons decline. It's a different deal in Morro Bay, and we now have that flexibility because of the zoning that we got a couple years back. So I think we'll probably hear more about that, depending on how Brant did this year. If the production was as bad as we think it was, I would expect our midwinter index to drop, and we'll be out of that liberalization threshold. The question on the youth hunt in Northeast. These are operated under federal rules, and these require youth that are 15 years or younger, that is not old enough to own or need to require a federal duck stamp, to be hunting in the field accompanied by a non-hunting adult. The intent of these things is complete mentoring. There's no competition between the adult and the youth and none of that business. So Fred's got a point. You know, September, it's ugly, right? But they're going to have to learn that sometime. The bag limit's one pintail. It's either one or two hen mallards, whether you're an adult or an immature. They've got their best chance to learn that with somebody sitting them right next to them in the blind and helping them through it. And we've gone before the season up there because the federal rules only allow it before or after. Well, after a season, you're talking mid to late January in northeastern California, pretty rugged hunt, not a lot of birds up there. So the question is it 1 or 2 weeks? If it's 1 week, which is where we started out, what we got was a fair bit of feedback from the normal opening hunting contingent that the role of the youth hunt had spoiled the bird opportunity for them on the opener day. And there's some validity to that. We tried that in the balance of state zone and where we could track harvest. There is an effect. The birds have been shot. It's not opening day anymore. They've been shot at, and they know it, and they know what the drill is. So there is an effect, and that's why we've moved to the 2 weeks before. So, you know, there are other alternatives, of course. You could delay the opener in northeast so that the youth hunt would occur at a time when there will be more migrants as time progresses. But really, between September 26th and October 4th or October 11th, the coloring factor is not going to change a whole lot. So it's true. Everything Fred said is true. But I think what's different about this is the mentored hunt. The goal of these hunts is to get people out there to learn to hunt with somebody sitting right next to them. So they don't have to learn like probably some of us did, which is go pick it up and, you know, oh, yeah, that's what that is. So that's the difference, and I think that's our rationale for that.
Thank you, Dan. Next speaker.
Walt Manziel, followed by Greg Yeris, followed by Bill Gaines.
Walt Manziel, again representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. We concur with the department's recommendations. We appreciate the concerns over the brant in Morro Bay and want to support a continued hunt there. For that very special bird, we concur with the proposed junior hunts, even though we recognize the coloring of the bird problem. One thing we'd like to explore with respect to juniors is some kind of program at the state and federal refuges where we might be able to maybe pick one, I don't know, Gray Lodge or one somewheres in the Sacramento Valley perhaps, where we could encourage hunters. Every hunter has a right to bring, that has a reservation, to bring two junior hunters with them. Very few do. And I wonder if we might create an experimental program where we could ask hunters, adult hunters without any juniors with them, would you be willing to go on a list to mentor a junior hunter not of your family if we can sign you, you know, pair you up with one through some kind of an experimental program on the refuge on a Saturday or Sunday. Would be strictly, I think we should try it one place or something to start with. It would just give another chance for juniors to come out, something I don't think would require any change in regulations or anything else, just a voluntary program that we could see perhaps a local sportsman's club getting involved in this kind of an operation and see what we could do. Thank you.
Thank you, Will.
Greg Yeris, followed by Bill Gaines.
Good morning, President, members of the Commission. My name is Greg Yeris. Can you hear me okay, Jim? Okay. The Director of Conservation Policy for the California Waterfowl Association. Just give you a little background. I worked as a biologist for CWA from 1986 until about 4 or 5 years ago. Then I did what Bob McClanders calls, took my sabbatical from CWA and went and worked for the USGS for a time doing waterfowl research for them. And when CWA helped to form COA and Bill and Mark and that organization to do more legislative activity, we felt we needed someone that was policy-oriented, that had a biological background, to sort of backfill what Bill and the COA folks were doing. And I'm sort of the go-between between CWA and COA. So if hope that clarifies some of the questions you may have on our relationship. Anyway, regarding the Western Mallard model, I really think that this is a real landmark day, actually, because this is something that I've been seeing being worked on for at least 20 years. If you talk to Dan Perigary, he'll tell you it's been going on for at least 50 years on some of these earlier flyway meetings. And so I see this as finally, you know, basing it on Pacific flyway biology is really a big step. And I'd really like to commend especially Dan and the person before him, Dan Connolly, Melanie and Sean, his staff, and everyone on the waterfowl staff, because they have really pushed this at the study committee level and at the council level every year over the past 20 years, trying to get them. And let's face it, in Idaho, in Montana, ducks is not on their top priority. They're big game states, and Dan and his staff was very instrumental in making sure this stayed on the front burner and finally got accomplished. So I want you guys to realize that how instrumental DFG staff is in getting this through. And I know the other states are also appreciative of it, the duck hunters in those states. One thing this will do is it will be a commitment now to the department and the commission to maintain those monitoring systems that are in place, whether it be banding or whether it be surveying, because that data now is being used to determine our regulations on an annual basis. So it's critical. In the past, you guys have approved funding through a duck stamp money to be used for that purpose, and we hope you'll continue to do that. One thing we have learned in this process is our western mallards can sustain a higher harvest than some of the other states. In fact, it's not that they can sustain a higher harvest. We seem to be harvesting them at a lower level, which is why you see the new model looking like it's going to be liberal, you know, for every year for, you know, here until most of us are still hunting. And part of that is because it is based on biology. It is based on biology of western mallards. May I continue? Thank you. And I think that's why even in years where, let's face it, we've had a drought this year, production is not that good. Our local mallard population is down, but the harvest levels will still be low enough where it's not going to have an impact on the following year's populations. I think that's important to note because in the Mississippi and Central flyways, they do have a higher harvest rate on mallards. I'd like to say that CWA met this week, as Dan mentioned, it was last week, how time flies. That was earlier this week. And our board of directors did concur with DFG on the regulations. We fully support the recommendations that Dan has put before you. I think being cautious on the hens is a good idea. This model is new. We're still putting data into it. Most of the data we're putting in is from 1990 on. So John, some of the mallards that you put bands on back in 1987, I don't know if we're included in this. John did work for CWA for a time putting mallard bands on, and he was instrumental in this program as well.
I wasn't going to admit that, Craig, but
I know. Now I know the only time
he's been hoping that would fall off the radar screen.
Now, of course, the only time he gets his shoes muddy is when he hits his ball into the water hazard, right, John? I think the caution on hens is also warranted, given that graph that Dan showed is especially good at illustrating that point. The movement from 7 to 5 drakes is not going to have a darn bit of difference on the overall harvest of the falling population, whereas the harvest on hens might. We don't know for sure. Most data says it won't. But given that this is a new model and we're just starting with it, there's no problem with being a little overly cautious in this case. We did conduct a telemetry study back in the late 80s and just repeated it just recently in the early 2000s. And Department of Fish and Game was part of that. It was a joint venture sponsored study. And it did show that in the periods where the bag limits were one hen and a total bag of 4, the harvest rate or the harvest was 10% less in years where they had that minimum bag. So we may see overwinter survival improve by about 10% if these data are correct. And that was similar to what Dan showed in his graph. I think his showed it was somewhere between 20 and 30 possibly. So within the state, on the ground data with using radio telemetry supports that. So anyway, I'd also like to comment on the late season goose hunt in Imperial Valley. I think that's a great idea, implementing the SHARE program. CWA and Co. will continue to help with providing access on those grounds. And I think providing additional opportunity when you can, when white goose populations are like this, and as Dan mentioned, a win-win situation, I think we need to take advantage of that situation. So Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Any questions? No. Thanks, sir.
Thanks, Greg. And I, for the record, I will admit that the seasonal job I had with CWA 21 years ago was one of the best jobs I've had, no doubt. Not as good as this job, but, you know, it was...
I understand.
It was, riding four-wheelers around and chasing ducks. My relatives couldn't believe I was getting paid for that. You know, it was just crazy.
We can't believe you're getting paid for this.
I set him up, you know. I set him up with Queen. Bill Gaines. Try and follow that, Bill. Come on now.
You again, Gaines?
Don't tell us
who you represent. We know.
Okay, I won't bother. I will say that the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance has had the pleasure of working very, very closely with the Department of Fish and Game and the California Waterfowl Association over the course of the last several weeks and months, coming together on our recommendation today. The California Outdoor Heritage Alliance is pleased and has taken a hard look at and does not take the decision lightly in regards to our recommendations on waterfowl regulations, and we are very pleased to support the recommendations that are brought forth by the Department of Fish and Game today. I won't reiterate what Greg Ayer said. He did a good job talking about how the reduction in hens will, in our opinion, address the concern that we may have in regards to the populations of mallards dropping a little bit. I do want to talk a little bit about the late season hunt, the Imperial Valley hunt. The California Waterfowl Association, my staff and I were very pleased to create the SHARE program, the Shared Habitat Alliance for Recreational Enhancement Program, with legislation that we sponsored and passed into law back in 2003. It is a public access to private lands program, recognizing that a lot of the top-notch hunting opportunity in our state is on private lands, and landowners have severe concerns, as they should, over liability concerns of letting the public hunt on their lands. One of the main components of the SHARE program legislation was to address those liability concerns. We were very pleased to work with the Farm Bureau and the California Cattlemen's Association in crafting the liability relief language of that legislation. As Dan Perry-Gary mentioned, for the past 2 years, the SHARE program has played an integral role on making the northeastern late-season Aleutian Canada goose management hunt a success. Again, that hunt, as is proposed for the Imperial Valley, is on private lands only. The intent is to move those birds off of those private lands and put them on the public lands that are there for them to forage on. It's been very successful over the course of the last 2 years up in the Eureka and Humboldt area on Aleutians. We do strongly support the late-season hunt that's being proposed for snow geese and white geese down in the Salton Sea Imperial Valley area this year. The SHARE program will play an incredibly important role in getting the public out on those private lands in that case as well. The legislation that we wrote actually calls for the Department of Fish and Game to work closely with the conservation organizations in implementing the SHARE program. We're very well aware of the budget constraints that the Department of Fish and Game is currently under, and the California Waterfowl Association and COA have been very pleased to take the lead, if you will, on the pilot program that we've ran for the last 2 years up on the North Coast. We're more than willing to do it again one more time this year down in the Imperial Valley, and we stand ready to work with the landowners and Fish and Game on that. Again, we'll be willing to take the lead on that. But next year, we'd like to see the Department of Fish and Game step up to the plate and take the lead on administering the SHARE program as the legislation calls them to do. Again, we know the budget situation may not be any better next year, but here's the good news. The Farm Bill that was recently passed into law back in Washington by a veto-proof margin both in the House and Senate does include an open fields provision, which provides millions of dollars for public access to private lands programs throughout the United States. They actually use the SHARE program. The language was largely written by the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, TRCP. We are very pleased to work with them on writing that language. They use the SHARE program as their model for getting that language into the Farm Bill. And it was passed into law. There will be millions of dollars available starting next year. We will work very closely with Fish and Game to see to it that those dollars are applied for. Short summary is they should have adequate money next year to implement the SHARE program here in California. The conservation organizations certainly stand ready to help them do that. But we urge the commission to urge the department to see to it that they don't miss that opportunity and that they do take the lead with the help of those funds next year in implementing the SHARE program in partnership with the conservation organizations.
Thank you, Bill. Sankey, what are our current plans with the department for that?
Well, we're going to look at it, certainly.
Money, Sankey, money.
No. Well, I don't think we need the SHARE program to implement or take advantage of the access dollars. I think there's more options available to us. Just as a reminder, the statute that created the SHARE program has a structural issue that has been problematic for us. I think we can work around it, and I know Eric Loft's staff have been looking at ways of doing that and then going through a very elaborate administrative set of hoops. But, yeah, we're looking forward to it. It's a great opportunity. It's been the SHARE program or its likeness in Humboldt's been a great success story. The farmers like it. The hunters like it. And we look forward to helping COA and our partners repeat the thing in Imperial County and elsewhere, especially with the farm bill.
Mr. Kellogg, do you have a comment?
Is that the end of the public speakers?
Yes.
Then I would like to move the motion the staff's going to read that coincide with the department's recommendation.
Okay. Why don't you read the motion? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm going to second that, but I also would suggest that if we are going to consider the department getting involved in the SHARE program, that possibly Commissioner Kellogg and myself and any others might need to go down to Imperial County and actually check out the program and see how that's working this fall. I think it'd be important to have some.
That's a good idea.
Thank you.
You know, I'm starting to like you, Commissioner Richards. That's a good suggestion. Anyway, Zonke.
The department would like to add.
Here's the buzz killer. What do you have to say here?
I'm here to add to the buzz. We highly appreciate and it would be wonderful if the commissioners could have a chance to personally experience and observe some of these programs because we think it's very important. It helps you understand what's actually going on in the field. So anything we can do to encourage that participation in one way or another, let us know.
Thank you, sir.
I've been trying to involve myself in that Black Brant situation in Morro Bay for a long time, just haven't been able to find the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're letting you know, Sonke. So do you need any more notice?
I'll escort you down there.
That's fine.
Just don't give Sonke the first shot. I've learned the hard way. That's just not a good idea.
You do a lot better with the Brants up there if you just put your kayak away.
We have three suggested motions from staff, and there's three because we have a final environmental document that needs to be certified first,
right,
before the regulations can be adopted. First suggested motion on certification of the document, that the Fish and Game Commission hereby certifies that the final environmental document on migratory waterfowl has been completed in compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act, in that it was presented to the commission and that the commission has reviewed and considered the information contained in the final environmental document prior to approving the project. The certified environmental document provides that there are no significant adverse environmental impacts resulting from the proposed project. The commission finds on the basis of facts in the record and the environmental document that the proposed project and the alternatives will have no significant adverse impact.
That motion has been proposed and or moved and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. Next motion.
Second motion, summary of proposed project and alternatives. The Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to Section 21080.5 of the Public Resources Code, hereby adopts the proposed project or alternative for the proposed regulatory action relating to Section 502, Title 14, regarding migratory waterfowl.
That motion has been moved and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous.
Possible adoption of regulations, the third suggested motion. Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the authority vested by Sections 202 and 355 of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, or make specific Sections 202, 355, and 356 of said code, hereby amend Section 502, Title 14, regarding the 2008-2009 Migratory Waterfowl Regulations. Further, the Commission directs staff to prepare a notice of determination consistent with the approval and adoption of associated regulations. This notice of determination is to be filed with the Secretary for Resources pursuant to Section 781.5, Title 14, and Section 21080.5 of the Public Resources Code. Please note that the regulatory language will be included on the Commission's website.
This has been moved and seconded. Any discussion?
This is the department's recommendation. I'm sorry, this includes the department's recommendation that was presented today.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Unanimous. Thank you. 19.
Item 19, discussion and possible adoption of proposal to amend Section 300, Title 14, CCR, related to upland game birds. My understanding is Dan Perigary from the department is going to talk about this.
You understand incorrectly. I see a head shake back
there. So, Sonkey, do you have anything to say?
The basics is we're adding a fall season to turkey hunting in San Diego County. We're extending the falconry season to coincide with the opening of the archery upland season, and we're creating a bag limit for Eurasian collared doves of unlimited during the regular dove season. That's a summary.
Well, he'll be back.
Okay. We do have two public speakers on this, Walt Manzel, followed by Bill Gaines.
Walt Manzel, again, representing California Rifle and Pistol Association. There's been a political reason for many years why we didn't have a turkey season in San Diego County, not a biological reason. And if we can have a turkey season in San Diego County, we're all in favor of that. I had very direct contact with some of the landowners down there years ago when they bowed their neck that we don't want to create a trespass problem after turkeys on our ranches. Hopefully the turkeys have scattered enough that there's some on public land, and some of the landowners maybe have woken up to the fact that they can allow some hunting without creating the cows quit giving milk or whatever. Thank you.
Thank you, Walt.
Bill Gaines.
Again, Bill Gaines, president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I realized that, the last month's meeting, actually it was a June meeting, if my memory serves me right, in Upland. We just had a handful of commissioners there. One of the things that I did testify on, though, during that meeting was the concern of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance and the National Wild Turkey Federation in regards to the spring season additional turkey hunt, which had been proposed once again by the Department of Fish and Game to run the final 2 weeks after the close of the regular season. Again, the intent of that hunt is to provide additional turkey hunting opportunity for youth, to hopefully encourage them to join the ranks of the sportsmen and women here in California, and obviously their success is incredibly important to their future enthusiasm for the sport. At Commissioner Richard's request, I did follow up and provided some information in regards to what other states do. I think off the top of my head, I've got the information here in front of me, but I believe there's about 25 other states that do have additional spring turkey seasons, and I believe that 23 out of that 25 actually have them before the season, when the chance for success is much greater than it is after the season. Again, I brought some extra copies of that I'll be happy to provide today of my letter dated July 14th to Commissioner Richards. But again, we would like to ask the commission to direct the department to rework their proposal for the 2009 spring additional turkey season hunt for youth, so that it would allow for the additional youth turkey season to take place the 2 days prior to the opening of the general season. The weekend prior, I should say, for 2 days to the opening of the general season, as opposed to the 2 weeks following the season. So we're willing, in essence, to give up 12 days in the hopes that we can do that for the weekend prior to the season to enhance the chances for youth success in the field. We have some time to do that. Again, we're talking March 2009 before that season takes place. So again, I'd like to follow up on my comments in Upland in June, my letter to Commissioner Richards a little bit earlier last month, and ask a commission to direct the department to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
I missed that Upland meeting, but I kind of concur, Sonkey, with what they're asking. I think that it's be advantageous for the youth to have that season ahead of the season rather than behind it.
I'm going to. Any more public comment? Okay. In honor of my good friend and our counsel, Deb Barnes, I want to make sure that everybody knows the email that Bill sent me, I did forward on to my fellow commissioners, and also shared with them my belief that 2 days before the season was appropriate and was the right time to do that. So I don't want anybody confused or misinformed. And I still think it's a good idea.
So I'm out of trouble. I have not seen my email for 3 weeks.
So. And furthermore, I have never heard from Jim Kellogg in an email, ever.
Jim who? Okay. Go ahead.
All I want to say is thank you, Commissioner Richards, for that.
We're running scared in front of you, Deb.
If only.
Okay. If only is right.
So Saki Mastrip was going to make a comment. Oh, here he comes back.
Excuse me, I was consulting my esteemed waterfowl staff on upland game regulations.
Out in the parking lot.
If I heard Bill Gaines, just a little background. We heard you, and we'll definitely in future years bring you a broader array of options for things like before or after turkey seasons. This is one of those things that just didn't get on the plate in terms of your options. My apologies. You'll have it next time. My only concern of trying to fix it for this March is you're going to, after this meeting, the regulation book will go into print that says otherwise, and we can put a supplement. I just wanted to be aware, enforcement always gets on me when we put out conflicting regulations, and I would actually ask Nancy to decide whether it's significant or not. I can't judge that. That's the only downside of adopting regulations and then redoing them for this March, just so you're fully aware. Nancy, you want to speak to that at all, or?
Saki, why do we have to send it out tomorrow? I mean, why are we going to print it and mail it if we haven't made that decision yet?
Dove season opens in, 3 weeks now? We have to get the reg booklets out. All the upland game seasons open very quickly in September.
Okay.
And if we don't have regulations out on the streets, it causes all kinds of grief.
Well, yeah, but we're still approving regulations at this point, so...
Today.
That's my point.
Right.
So... What's the difference?
Well, the difference is for the early...
No, I understand the difference on the date, but if we're approving regulations today and we changed regulations for five different things in there, wouldn't the printer be changing those regulations?
Let me back up. When you adopt the regulations today, mm-hmm. we're on such a tight timeline, they probably go to press this afternoon.
Okay.
And they print the regulations. Now, if you now in 3-4 months... change the regulation again, you're going to have to issue a supplement because those regs will already be printed. So
right.
Now you have two different rules out on the street. That's the situation. In the past, that causes enforcement all kinds of grief. I don't want to speak for enforcement, so I would have Nancy. Sometimes it doesn't matter.
There's a misunderstanding here, Saki.
Oh.
And I'm not going to speak for Commissioner Richards, but the question is, if we make changes today, they will be reflected in the reg book.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's why we're waiting for it.
Another layer here, Commissioner Richards, is there certain things, though, that are in front of you that are amongst the alternatives that you commissioners can select. I don't believe the couple days before the season is amongst the alternatives in the eyesore or the environmental document.
Correct. My apologies for confusing.
The notice is not appropriate.
Yeah, unfortunately, during earlier deliberations, the department did not, for a number of reasons, did not submit an early junior hunt before the turkey season as one of your regulatory options. It gave you an after season. To do that, we would have to go to a new notice. We actually have to modify the environmental document, probably. So it'll take us a few months to catch up to do this by March. It can be done. I'd prefer Nancy contemplate, is this a problem if we have two different regs on this issue or not? In fishing, it's a nightmare. Generally, I'd say no way. But this is a little different. And Nancy, can you speculate?
Commissioners, it's always difficult when you have conflicting regulations, one that's printed in a book and then you have flyers that come out. First, it doesn't notify everyone. So some people will have just the printed regulations that we send out, not anticipating that things such as this would be changing. And so you'll have some people in the field at a time that isn't in a regulation book. So we'll either have people that feel that they haven't been afforded the opportunity to hunt the early season, or you'll have people that will be calling because they have the regulation book and nobody's supposed to be in the field at that time because they don't have the flyer. For the court system, it becomes even more complicated because you have two different regulations, and our regulations are hard enough for us to get into the court system without conflicting regulations. But if in fact you approve it, we would do the best we could with what you provided to us.
Nancy, that being said, we actually had an incident like that last year with the canvas back change. And I'd just like to ask, how many enforcement problems did you have with that?
Yeah, I don't know, sir.
Yeah. Well, I hear what you're saying, but if we could make that a before season instead of an after season and have to put out a supplement, I think it's worth it personally.
Can you do something I don't want to overcomplicate this. I mean, I would hate to see us wait a year. If you have to wait, we have to wait. But can you do something in your current regulations on the youth hunt that literally says in there that we're contemplating a change and please pay attention to that, to potential change?
Actually, we could do that. I was about to say what I would recommend if you want to contemplate this is leave the after season hunt there. Because it's a bigger problem when you have a rule book that says you can and then you say that you can't. That's a worse situation than having an opportunity that no one knows about and doesn't take advantage of.
Absolutely. So
could we put something in the after-season youth hunt that says, please be aware the commission's considering a change on this and look on the website or whatever.
In the reg booklet, what we can do is put the regulations you adopt today and then put a caveat, pay attention, there may be a pre-season junior hunt opportunity available. Contact or watch our website. We do those things, and we could do that. And I'm sure our partners, including COA, would help us get the word out. I just didn't want to.
Well, I think the written is very important, and I think you're right on the money with that. So if we had something in there, I think that. And then would the suggestion be that we leave the after season as well?
If you're going to adopt it today, definitely leave it and don't get rid of it later.
So that stays.
You would have to do that.
We're saying there may be a preseason hunt, so please pay attention to that.
Yeah, you would have both before, and trust me, we have plenty of turkeys.
Yeah, I understand that, and their concerns are rightly so. It gets a lot tougher as they go along, get a lot wilier. So, Jim,
Adriana, did you have a comment?
I want to clarify, was this part of the environmental document?
No. Yeah, we're stuck on this one as far as.
No, well, here's the thing. You've got time before next spring to do a new document.
I think where Adriana was going is, could we bootstrap this somehow now? The answer is no.
Well, we covered that.
We would have to re-notice. The changes are minor. Unfortunately, due to APA, we got to go through the process. I saw counsel reaching for the mic.
Well, it sounds to me like it's the commission's will to consider this, to go ahead with the regulations as we currently do. I think that's the consensus of what I'm hearing. So we'll go ahead. That language that we are considering a before season youth hunt is probably very important to insert to alert everyone. Your ideas about getting everyone cooperation with respect to this is great, and I think that we will have to calendar proceeding with doing all the things we have to do in order to get it done before the season.
Right. So the department will make sure I get to do one of those hold the presses phone calls as soon as we adjourn. Get that language in there that there's a possibility, just so I'm clear, and that the department will, as soon as possible, start the process of developing a notice to add that opportunity
for the
March season.
Is that my fellow commissioner's consensus on that in that regard? Okay. So let's then proceed with what we're doing.
So I would say we get an update from the department at the next meeting on the what the plan is for the environmental document.
Okay.
If it is just an addendum, it might be a truncated. We'll have to.
I don't think it'll be much. It's just we have to follow process, and that's our issue. And the process, unfortunately, is at least a few months, but it'll be in time for March.
Okay. So and we're done with public hearing. You have a suggested motion, so let's have it.
We're good.
Before we go on to the consent calendar, I'd like to. I wanted to ask Dan Paraguay a question that might be interesting to all of us. Dan,
still on this regs pack. Okay.
Well, are we done? Oh,
No, we're not quite done. We have to have a motion.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought you were moving to the.
And we'll segue to your concern right after that.
All right.
Read the motion, if you will.
Yes, suggested motion to adopt upland game birds. Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the authority vested by Sections 200, 202, 203, 355, and 356 of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, and make specific Sections 200, 203, 356 of said code, hereby amend Section 300, Title 14, relating to upland game birds. Please note the regulatory language will be included in the Commission's website.
And that is to include the discussion that we have just had with respect to a warning. Can you state that in some way?
Well, that's not part of the regs. That would be a courtesy parenthetical message.
Notice, not a warning. Notice, opportunity.
No, not a warning. Parenthetical notice.
It will be a parenthetical in the reg book, and that
doesn't
need to be.
Do I hear a proposal? You move that one?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. Thank you. Jim, you had a question.
Dan, sure. I just out of curiosity, we had voted a while back to allow Harry Adamson to do our duck stamp, and I was wondering, I heard rumors that he's actually doing a brand new painting just for that, and I was wondering what the status of it was.
Well, that's a great question. I'm not really sure I know the full answer. I saw an image that was released at the Decoy Show in Sacramento that was, I thought, going to be our image, and it should be at the printer
now. Actually,
so.
If you want a little more explanation, we did have it on the screen at the Upland meeting.
It's really sad.
Director Don Cook was able to share that. I don't know if we still have it in the system here from AGP. Probably not.
But if you do, I'd like to show that to Commissioner Kellogg. You may have it.
Yeah, at the Upland meeting,
yes,
we have an image, and it is a nice image. Jim, does anybody have it on there? Sankey, do you have a...
Actually, I might have.
John, do we have a copy of that?
I'm pretty sure I will, as soon as I get my little memory stick back from Greg.
Your memory stick, okay. Good idea. So we could do a consent calendar while they're loading that up and then show it, Jim. It is a nice image.
Why don't we do that? It is a great image.
Yeah. On consent calendar, I want to confirm with Sankey that the department would like to pull item 22E off of the consent calendar. That is...
That's the Diamond C PLM.
Diamond C Outfitter PLM.
See?
Yeah, we're renegotiating terms, and it'd be best if we pulled it and finish that before having you adopt it.
Okay. Thank you.
So the suggested motion from staff is items move the Fish and Game Commission hereby approves its August 8th, 2008 consent calendar. Items 20 through 23, except for 22E, is removed.
So moved.
May I hear a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Unanimous. Okay.
I can go to...
keep going, and we're still looking
at the
announcement
of future meetings. Yes. Yes, let me mention that. Good question. The October meeting, which you just approved on consent calendar...
Did all you guys see the duck stamp?
Huh? Yes, we did.
Thank you.
I think they're going to pop it on the screen in a second also, but thanks, Sankey.
Go ahead and put it up when you get it.
An explanation on what you just voted to ratify on the consent calendar is moving our North Central Coast Study Region, our bishop meeting to Santa Rosa is what we staff found a location in Santa Rosa. It's the Pink Flamingo Hotel.
You got to be kidding me.
And Jim, I know you remember that room. We have a much larger room. We have a room. They have had a major renovation, several million dollar renovation. At this late notice, and we needed 200 plus seats because that could be a very crowded meeting. We checked all of the public areas that none of them were available. The other hotels were not available except a couple were exorbitant prices. That we have a 200 plus room, and they can outflow up to 600 people for us. So since that's going to be the first one on the North Central Coast, we needed a big room.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah. Adriana loves the pink flamingo. I don't know what the problem is here. Okay.
You're picking on Adriana again.
So for everybody's information, the image on the screen now and coming over the internet, that is Harry Adamson's graciously prepared and donated to the department image for this year's duck stamp.
Yeah, on the smaller television, the colors really show. This projected image isn't much, but that's really something.
We're also Deputy Director Mastrip. We're eagerly awaiting announcement of how these prints are available to the public, you know, as an art print. But, I mean, the mechanism for that, we've asked some questions and they haven't gotten any response yet. There's definitely going to be a demand, I think, with a Harry Adamson print for several folks in the public to get these prints. And I know commissioners are interested also. As far as announcement of future meetings, next month, September 4th and 5th, we're in Kings Beach, Commissioner Gustafson's backyard. October 2nd and 3rd, we will be in Santa Rosa. November 13th, 14th, Huntington Beach, and then we finish this calendar year in December 11th, 12th in Sacramento.
Do I hear a motion to adjourn, or do any of the commissioners have any other business?
I just have one thing. Can you put that duck stamp back up for a minute?
Oh, here we go.
This is important because
come on,
I wanted
you guys
to show
get it up there.
Commissioner Kellogg, he didn't see there was a nuance to that I had noticed when we were down there. As I was looking at the picture, I was trying to determine were they landing or taking off, and I thought that's probably what they look like to Carlson when he's shooting behind the birds as they're leaving. You can see the water shooting up right there. Did you notice that, Jim?
Oh, that's rude.
I'm afraid
that's cold.
On that note, I'll move for adjournment.
I don't want to admit that they never get off the water when I'm shooting. Come on.
It's called potting, not shooting. I heard a second.
Second.
All those in favor? Aye. We stand adjourned.